much to get to for the JFK show. And one of these is this incredibly cool book that I've had sitting on my desk now for about 2 months that I've been reluctant to open because I don't want to take it out of its wrapping. It's one of my favorite things I'll ever have gotten working for Coast to Coast, and that is a signed copy of the Warren Commission signed by Gerald Ford. Tim Miller is behind the publication of this, and good evening, Tim.
Good evening, Ian.
All right, now this is part of the Flat Signed Pressed series. Can you talk about that a little bit right away?
Yes, the series is a matching. These are leather-bound books with raised hubs, silk moiré end sheets. If your listeners can imagine, I'm sure they've seen commercials, if not in person, the most gorgeous books in the world with all the bells and whistles.
Right.
And special with this book because I didn't want anyone to ever question, you know, did Gerald Ford really hand-sign these? Every book comes with a COA, a certificate of authenticity, but also, and even better, every book comes with a photograph of Gerald Ford actually signing the book.
That particular book.
Absolutely. This particular book he
that
signed
is the
in
coolest
his office.
Thing. That is the coolest thing. Now, I have it shrink wrapped. I have never taken it out of its shrink wrapping because I don't want to mess with it. I think it's the neatest heirloom. Should I, in order to preserve its historic and true collector's value, should I leave it in the shrink wrap?
I think that you should open it right now, and then we'll send you another one.
Oh, no. You don't have to do that. No. I don't want to. This is so cool. I just wanted people to know, in order to describe what this Warren Commission printing looks like, I guess the way I would say is it's like a very fancy church Bible.
There you go. And if you look at the very top on the cover, you'll see a very special seal. And that seal can only be used by a U.S. president. And that seal tells the whole story. If anybody else were to use that except for a president, including Gerald Ford, of course,
right,
it is illegal. So Gerald Ford had to give permission to use that gold seal stamped not only on the cover of the book, but also on the signed page inside.
Now, you were in contact, obviously, with Gerald Ford to arrange this. He must have done this fairly late into his life, correct?
About 3 years before he passed away, and we had no idea that this was going to be his final book, but that's the way it ended up. This was the final book he wrote, and this is the Warren Commission, as you say, but he wrote a completely new foreword specifically and exclusively just for this book. And in that foreword, he talks about everything from the JFK assassination to 9/11, and he himself gets into the conspiracy here, and he gives new information, which we're going to talk about, but
yeah.
He gives his comment on everything from George Bush to 9/11 to the world and politics and his thoughts on some of the key individuals, the world leaders.
It is about the coolest gift, and I endorse this because I know that sometimes – especially, you know, as an uncle gets older or as a beloved grandparent, or so, it gets harder to buy a really cool gift for them. I just think this is the neatest thing. An autographed copy of the Warren Commission, and it's all – there's a certificate of authenticity in the back, and everything's signed and numbered and the whole bit. Now, let's get to the to what he says, what Gerald Ford writes about in this exclusive new foreword to the Warren Commission. I'm just going – not having – you know, open my shrink wrapping. I'm assuming that he is still defending the Warren Commission's original conclusions.
Yes and no, because this book, and let me tell you, before I worked with Gerald Ford, I was not a believer in the conspiracy theories out there. I was a simple little bookseller from Tennessee, and I became a publisher. This was the very first book I ever published, and then came the other books from Buzz Aldrin and Braveheart and books from Hal Moore, We Were Soldiers, but this was the very first book I ever published. And he and I debated heavily at times, and Gerald Ford was a good man. I'm not saying to the contrary, but he actually cursed me for wanting to put more about the conspiracy and to put some of what I found out to be the truth in this book. But In the end, he did give us the smoking gun. In this book, he admits for the first time anywhere that the CIA did destroy documents covering up the JFK assassination.
Now, that's so interesting because that actually is very much a part of our other two guests coming up later on in the evening. But talk about that a little bit more. That was difficult for him to admit that?
Very much so. It was very difficult for him because he had... Now, this is my opinion, but I don't think anyone will disagree with this. In 1964, when he was on the Warren Commission, I believe he gave his word then and there that he would never go back on his word to keep to the point that Lee Harvey Oswald was the only shooter. And actually, several people on the commission did recant. It's actually unusual that Gerald Ford honored that commitment and never changed his commitment, even though it's become obvious there was a conspiracy.
And he said in the foreword, he said that the CIA did in fact destroy some documents. Does he explain what the motivation could possibly be for the CIA to get involved in what is at its core a domestic murder investigation?
And you hit the nail on the head. You know, and your listeners probably know, that the CIA is not supposed to be involved in domestic affairs.
Nope.
So that itself is illegal, right?
Yep.
So he admits that. So he admits the CIA broke the law right there. That's why this is the smoking gun.
And in saying this, does he know which documents they destroyed?
There's a lot more information that I have time to share with you, but I'll talk with you all you want to. There's more information at a website, presidentgeraldfordbook.com. He does go into why he believes the CIA did destroy the documents. In the end, he kind of straddles the fence, and he says, well, was the CIA simply freaking out, basically, and doing things without the orders from above? Well, come on. Can you imagine a CIA officer doing anything without the orders from above?
Right, right. Well, very interesting. Now, if you have if he had more information, did you ever get the impression he had more information than he was telling you?
Absolutely. What he was interested in doing was maintaining his legacy. Just like all presidents want to do, presidents want to be remembered for the good and none of the bad. And a lot of bad things happened during not just the Ford administration, but every presidential administration. This book, he planned to be part of his legacy, and that was part of our deal. Not only was he in total control of the quality of the book, but he was in final total control of the final words. But what we are here announcing for the first time tonight is that the words he redacted from the publication we're going to make available to your listeners here tonight.
Okay. So that's at the website, or you've got more to say right now? Because you've got me so hooked.
Well, everybody who orders a copy of this book, and like you said, this is an incredible gift or a gift for your family or friends. And this isn't on the website, but I'm the owner of the company, and I'll make a special deal. Anybody who orders that book, I'm going to tell my staff next week, include free of charge 3 copies of that unpublished manuscript, and I'll autograph all 3 of those. Who knows if I'm killed, baby, or something one of these days too. But this exact book I've seen selling on eBay for $600-$800 just by itself, and we're going to give your listeners $100 off the price of just the book. So really, you get 4 books for the price of 1. And my request, because I really need the help of the listeners. You know, I wasn't one of those conspiracy theorists 5 years ago, but now I believe there was a conspiracy, and everyone needs to spread the word. And when you get these 3 copies of the unpublished manuscript, share them with your friends, give them away, get the word out, and let's start something that may turn into releasing the CIA files. which they were supposed to 10 years ago. Congress passed a law, literally, saying, CIA, you will release these documents. And they've been in court fighting reporters those whole 10 years saying, no, we're not going to release them, even though the CIA released what they call their family jewels.
Right.
When George W. became president, they released all their other secret files, admitting that they were part of the assassination and attempted assassination of world leaders, including Fidel Castro. And that's where the mafia comes into play here.
Sure does. And so where did Gerald Ford ever talk about the mafia connection? Because that will be very much central to the discussion in the last couple hours of the show.
You bet he talks about that in this new foreword that he wrote, and it's now considered, you know, pretty much fact that, well, it's not pretty much, it is an absolute fact that the government was working with the CIA. The government worked with the CIA to try to kill Fidel Castro, and don't forget Watergate, and that's how this ties into E. Howard Hunt, your guest coming up.
Yeah,
he was working with Hunt was part of the CIA, and Hunt controlled several of these operations, including Watergate. But he was also involved in the JFK assassination.
Sure, and we will get into that some more. And actually, E. Howard Hunt may be a recurring character tonight for the book Legacy of Secrecy as well, involving the deathbed confession of Carlos Marcello. But again, back to your book, then we'll just say you can connect up to Tim's publishing company, this wonderful leather-bound raised letter on the outside, gold leaf printed, beautiful flat sign press version of the Warren Commission signed by President Gerald R. Ford. Is available, and are you having a limited publishing run of these, or will you? Because I mean, you can't obviously he can't sign more of them, so you won't have more signed copies. But people will be able to get a copy of this even if you run out of the signed ones. Correct?
There are only 287 copies left, and there were originally 3,000. And I had one company come forward, and they wanted to buy every copy I had. And I said no. I knew I was going to be on this show, and I wanted to save 300 copies for your listeners. If only if they're the first 300, and then they get the free three copies of the unpublished manuscript, and I'll even give everybody a copy of the matching Buzz Aldrin autographed book. So really, you get five books now for the price
fabulous.
Of one.
And that's the signed Buzz Aldrin book.
Absolutely. It's a matching leather-bound set.
Okay.
They go side-by-side, hand-signed by Buzz Aldrin, and he charges $300 just for his autograph. But I want to get the word out to the public.
Good. I appreciate that. And ordinarily, we don't go so infomercial on the show, but this is worth it. And so I really do. I recommend it. It's the coolest thing to have a signed copy of the Warren Commission report with the special foreword by Gerald R. Ford. Thank you so much, Tim. Enjoyed our conversation. Go Vols. And I will look forward to seeing what else your company comes up with in the future. And I look forward to reading this forward, too, because it plays perfectly into Bond of Secrecy, St. John Hunt. We will replay the E. Howard Hunt deathbed confession coming up next on Coast to Coast with Ian Punnett. At the core of the show, which we're doing, and the ongoing discussion that we've been having on Coast to Coast AM for all these many years, there is a murder, and it was a real person who was killed. Although it feels like we are in some kind of gigantic game of Clue, right, where we're looking to see what's in the envelope. Was the assassination of JFK done by, you know, Cord Meyer with a candlestick in the library? We should always remember that there were real people involved in real pain and real families that were affected by it. That having been said, allow me to use that as a kind of apology in advance for the enthusiasm with which we will have much of this discussion throughout the course of the evening, because we will get carried away, and it will start to sound just like we're talking about, you know, players on a game board or characters in a movie. And I hope that that's okay, that we just make this recognition one time and then just get right back to what we are talking about, which in a way is the greatest game of Clue that has ever been played. And I think the whole country, the whole world would love to know the ultimate answer to who killed JFK. Was it merely just Lee Harvey Oswald? Doesn't even seem remotely possible after you read a book like Legacy of Secrecy, which we'll get to later on in the show. Or for that matter, when you hear the taped deathbed confession of E. Howard Hunt. And these two subjects will overlap each other beautifully. Bond of Secrecy is the new book out by St. John Hunt, the son of E. Howard Hunt. He talks about his father's involvement both in the death of JFK and Watergate, of course. And after Bond of Secrecy, Legacy of Secrecy. And the first thing I did when I got Legacy of Secrecy, I cracked open to the index to read how many times E. Howard Hunt is referenced. And I think you're going to be in for an amazing night. Plus, a couple of the other authors we've had on Coast to Coast tonight want to get in on this from their own angles with their own unique questions for the guests. More on that coming up, too. As we get started with St. John Hunt, and this hour we will replay the deathbed confession of E. Howard Hunt on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, he will always be one of my favorite guests on Coast to Coast. It's St. John Hunt, son of E. Howard Hunt, and now author St. John Hunt. Good evening.
Ian, it's just wonderful to talk with you again. It's been over a year,
yeah.
And I have listened to many of your shows. I love,
okay.
I'm a big fan of Coast to Coast, and you guys just amaze me at the dedication that you have proved.
Okay.
Day in and day out at the various causes that you undertake.
Thank you.
It's great to speak with you again, and I have to also give you kudos for the man who broke the tape nationally of my dad's confession.
You know what? And I will take that. I will take that to
you're the man.
To my grave that
you
I get to put
man.
That on my tombstone.
Oh, yeah.
Because I love the fact that we are so invested in this book. Now, tell me about Bond of Secrecy. I have a galley print of it. When does the book come out?
You know, Ian, I do not have a publisher. I have a literary.
I cannot believe that.
I have an agent in New York who claims he can't do anything with it, and I don't know if that's just a ruse by, you know, people that would stand to lose something if this book were to be published. So I offer it in two forms on my website, stjohnhunt.com, as an ebook for $5.99, and then I can have, you know, I go to Staples and have one printed up and bound, and that's available on my website too.
I'm going to tell you right now, stop that, and let's get you in contact with Tim Miller, who produced these beautiful leather-bound versions of the Warren Commission, and see whether or not he knows somebody, or maybe Flatiron Press would be willing to do it. And here's what I want to suggest to you, is that when you, and you will get a publisher for this, and you wrote it really well, too, by the
Thank
way.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
When you get a publisher for this, you have to include a CD of the deathbed confession so that somebody would have the book and the CD along with it.
That's a great idea, and I will definitely do
crucial.
That.
And I've had a couple of books that have that, and it's wonderful to have the audio.
It's a great combination. Of course it is, yeah. And, of course, in my book, the way it's available now, you can get all the handwritten memos and all the diagrams that my father wrote to me before he died. It's all there.
Okay. Well, we just got to stop you from having to go to Staples to print it out. I mean, that just doesn't.
But
that part.
You got to get the truth out somehow.
I know.
You know?
I understand. That's dedication yourself. So the ebook, great. You can link up to St. John Hunt through Coast to Coast AM.com. But in the meantime, let's go ahead and play the tape here in just a second. And for people who have never heard it before, let's bring them up to speed. You're one of E. Howard Hunt, former convicted Watergate conspirator. And admitted CIA, I don't know, he's your dad. How do you describe your father's involvement in international assassinations?
Oh, well, if there was a hot spot going on, if there was something something dirty that needed to be taken care of, my dad was the one to organize it and make sure things ran smoothly. He was the guy that would have lunch in the afternoon. He'd have an early lunch at the White House or the Langley headquarters of CIA with Dick Helms, and then later in the afternoon he'd take his tie off and roll his sleeves up and he'd be out in the trenches or fly to Miami and be down there training guerrilla, Cuban guerrilla fighters for the Bay of Pigs invasion. So he was the guy that was really the bridge between, the people with the ties and the suits that had names and reputations, and then the people that were down in the trenches doing all the dirty work. So he could pull it all together.
And do we know whether or not your dad pulled the trigger figuratively or whether he ever pulled the trigger on these operations himself?
You could say he pulled the trigger figuratively on these operations. I mean, in other words, you can hold him responsible certainly for the 25,000 to 65,000 deaths that occurred after the overthrow of the Guatemalan regime. You can hold him partially responsible for the death of Che Guevara, because Felix Rodriguez was working for my dad at the time, and Felix Rodriguez was the CIA contract agent that chased Che for 5 years and finally cornered him in the mountains of Bolivia and handed the pistol over to the Bolivian police so that the CIA couldn't officially be blamed for the murder of Che Guevara. You can hold my dad responsible for the many assassination attempts against Fidel Castro, the overthrow of the Arbenz government in Chile, and all of those type of things, and also his involvement in the JFK assassination, which I believe he was a point man at Dealey Plaza, setting up the triangulation fire for the three snipers that were there that day.
And yet, when he talks to you here on this tape, which we're going to play here in just a moment, he lays out for you something which surprised you in some respects, because he was willing to do it on tape. But he also gets into detail about some of the other names involved, Morales, Cordmeyer, some of the other names which we'll be talking about throughout the evening. And he really does do almost a journalist's work. He names names.
Yes, he does. He's very specific about things. And, of course, that was just, I wish I could have spent more time with my father, but the powers that be and the circle of influence that surrounded him in Miami prevented us from getting any farther. But I was privileged and honored that my father, relayed this information to me and made it my responsibility to bring this to the world, which you have been instrumental in helping me doing.
Yeah, well, thank you. You know, at the time, last time we spoke, you had become somewhat of a family pariah because you had released this tape, and that there were other people within your family and their lawyers and stuff that were getting involved with this. How does that stand right now as we approach Thanksgiving? What's the Hunt family Thanksgiving like these days?
That Hunt family, there is no Hunt family for me, but the Hunt family consists of me, my wife, and our children.
Right.
But the greater Hunt family of Miami, the Hunt family that are my sisters, that were raised by my father and my mother Dorothy, do not even admit that I exist.
Okay.
I have been cut off, from all forms of communication, and
sure.
I've been completely exiled from that family.
I'm sorry.
As a result of this, yeah.
As a result of this,
yeah.
When we play the tape here again, people who are listening, you might want to write down some of these names because we'll get back to them. But I don't want to spend too much time pre-selling what he's going to say here. But I did want to present the circumstances, and that's that E. Howard Hunt had he had talked to you about this before it went onto tape. And this is when you recorded this. This was a time when he didn't think he was going to make it, and he wanted this to be recorded. But then he recovered from this bout, wasn't it? And then you just held on to the tape until his ultimate passing?
Yes, that's correct. My father made this tape with great difficulty on his own after my first visit to Miami, which he disclosed his involvement in the conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy. And I had to leave. I spent a few days with him there. He wrote down all those memos that I have in the book. And then I received this unsolicited tape from him in the mail several weeks later. This was January 2004, and he was he'd been very, very sick, bouts of pneumonia, prostate cancer, gangrene in his leg, two operations of amputations, and so he's struggling here, but he's very clear about what he's saying.
And he did this on his own with great intention. This was not he wasn't under the influence of medication and you're standing over him with a microphone.
No.
He did this tape on his own.
He did this on his own from his hospital bed in Miami in secret with no one else knowing on a little portable Radio Shack cassette player with a handheld microphone with an on and off switch. And there was no one in that room with him at the time, and he sent this to me all the way out to California, and I just received it one day with no preliminary warning or anything, and I put it on my cassette player, and I just sat there and like, oh my God.
Right. Well, exactly. Well, so let's play it, and let me just say in advance, this is the mignon of that tape. There's a slightly longer version, and there's some longer pauses and stuff. So we this is our edit of it. But here it is, the deathbed confession of E. Howard Hunt, R.E., the JFK assassination on Coast to Coast. Roll it. Miguel, we had actually queued that up in advance. I'm sorry, with everybody, the tape was there. We okay, well, that was quite a buildup for a big dramatic blank pause.
Yeah.
No, I don't have it on this end. It should be there. You take a look for it. We still have time to get to it in just a second. Let me just tell you, when I was reading the book Legacy of Secrecy, this is coming up later on in the show, Lamar Waldron, your father plays prominently in this book. And
really?
they talk about him a lot.
Oh, wow.
And yet,
well,
I haven't gotten to the part where they make any reference to the actual confession, though, which is interesting. They talk about him, but they don't, at least I haven't come across where Lamar mentions this tape in particular.
Uh-huh. Well, that's interesting. I'll have to get a copy of that book and look and see what they've written about him.
But it is there. I mean, part of what they talk about is exactly what you experienced, a father who was seemingly had his sleeves rolled up in a lot of different things. Now, while OK, ready to go. Do we have time to get to it all? OK, here we go on Coast to Coast. Roll.
All right.
I heard from Frank that LBJ had designated Cord Meyer Jr. to undertake a larger organization while keeping it totally secret. Cord Meyer himself was a rather favored member of the Eastern aristocracy. He was a graduate of Yale University and had joined the Marine Corps during the war and lost an eye in the Pacific fighting. I think that LBJ settled on Meyer as an opportunist, Perrin like himself, Perrin, and a man who had very little left to him in life ever since JFK had taken Cord's wife as one of his mistresses. I would suggest that Cord Meyer welcomed the approach from LBJ, who was, after all, only the vice president at that time, and of course could not number Cord Meyer among JFK's admirers. Quite the contrary. As for Dave Phillips, I knew him pretty well at one time. He worked for me during the Guatemala project. He had made himself useful to the agency in Santiago, Chile, where he was an American businessman. In any case, his actions, whatever they were, came to the attention of the Santiago station chief, and when his resume became known to people in the Western Hemisphere Division, he was brought in to work on Guatemalan operations. Sturge and Morales and people of that ilk stayed in apartment houses during preparations for the big event. Their addresses were very subject to change, so that where a fellow like Morales had been one day, you're not necessarily associated with that same address the following day. In short, it was a very mobile experience. Let me point out at this point that if I had wanted to fictionalize what went on in Miami and elsewhere during the run-up for the big event, I would have done so. But I don't want any unreality to tinge this particular story, or the information, I should say. I was a bench warmer on it, and I had a reputation for honesty. I think it's essential to refocus on what this information that I've been providing you, and you alone, by the way, consists of. What is important in the story is that we've backtracked the chain of command up through Kornmeyer and laying the doings at the doorstep of LBJ. He, in my opinion, had an almost maniacal urge to become president. He regarded JFK as he was, in fact, an obstacle to achieving that. He could have waited for JFK to finish out his term and then undoubtedly a second term. So that would have put LBJ at the head of a long list of people who were waiting for some change in the executive branch.
It is as startling for me on the 10th hearing of that as it was on the first.
Yeah.
It's so amazing. Well, there's so many things we'll unpack coming up then in the next hour, and that is I want to go back to when he says the doings, the goings on in Miami, the run up for the big event.
Yeah.
And how he says he didn't want to fictionalize that.
Right.
I want you to talk about what your father was involved with in Miami, and then I also, even in hearing this again, I think it's so interesting to point out why he gave it to you, why he recorded this in the first place. So hang on, more with the author St. John Hunt. His book is an e-book. It's called Bond of Secrecy. We'll also talk a little bit about the new information out about Watergate with St. John Hunt next hour. It's our annual JFK show on Coast to Coast. And there's so much on that tape to get to this evening, including talking about it later on with the author of Legacy of Secrecy, a new book out, a new definitive book out about the JFK assassination on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponett. We're talking with St. John Hunt here, and I had seen the phones ring a few times, so I thought I'd throw the numbers up. We might get to a couple of your questions this hour on our annual JFK show. His book is Bond of Secrecy. Maybe his ears were burning because we were talking about St. John Hunt just last week with our guest Nina Burley. More on that, though, a little bit later on this hour. Let's get back to the big run-up for the big event that E. Howard Hunt talked about in his confession when we come back with St. John Hunt. We'll talk about the events in Miami and also why it was that E. Howard Hunt gave this tape to his son. Next, on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Ponick. St. John Hunt, the author of Bond of Secrecy, you can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. And, the very first hour of our JFK show here, we had been talking with Tim Miller, who was with Flatiron Press, and they've got this special limited edition out, assigned. Well, at least they had 300 left. I don't know how many are left. I hope people have been ordering them. But they had 300 left of the autographed copies of the Warren Commission.
Oh, signed, wow.
Signed by Gerald Ford, right? And in the foreword, a special foreword written for this book by Gerald Ford, Gerald Ford admitted for the first time that the CIA had destroyed documents after the JFK assassination. And he said that Gerald Ford admitted that the CIA had done something after a fact to cover up for an aspect of this murder investigation, which is weird. Seemingly it's a domestic case. There should be no CIA involvement in the assassination of the president at all. Nothing they should having to cover up for. But if anybody knows what documents were being destroyed, it would have been your dad, don't you think?
Yeah, he probably would have had a good idea about that, right, as it turns out, yeah.
And he said that Gerald Ford knew more than what he was willing to say. It was Tim Miller's impression.
Well, of course. I think many members of the Warren Commission either knew more than they're willing to put down on paper, or they specifically limited their investigation so that they wouldn't find answers that didn't fit in with their preconceived and pre-planned scenario of what happened that day. After all, J. Edgar Hoover was Johnson's man, and after Kennedy was murdered, Johnson enacted a ruling that gave J. Edgar Hoover lifetime as director of the FBI, which he was about. If Kennedy had remained alive, J. Edgar Hoover would have had to pass his mantle as director when he reached his 70th birthday in 1965. Of course, Kennedy died, and Johnson declared that J. Edgar Hoover was to have a lifetime as the director.
Right. Interestingly enough, too, I mean, he mentions in this tape, we just played before the top of the hour here on Coast to Coast, we played the deathbed confession of E. Howard Hunt. He talks about that LBJ obsession that he felt, that LBJ, this all eventually went up the line to LBJ, and it was all about LBJ's willingness to make these compromises to become president of the United States.
Yeah, and I think you have to look at LBJ's entire history as a politician and realize that that this was nothing out of the ordinary for Lyndon Johnson. His entire rise to power, starting with his becoming a senator in 1948, was fraught with illegal ballot stuffing and fraudulent land deals,
sure,
and big payoffs and slush funds and all of this kind of stuff. There was even some murders that had been attributed later on to Lyndon Johnson and some of his cronies in Texas. So, he ran against Kennedy in 1960 and lost. Kennedy won the nomination for the Democratic Party, and of course he realized that Johnson was important to put on the ticket, since he was a power broker there in the Southwest. But yet when Johnson became vice president, Kennedy kept him out of Washington and sent him on to missions in up to 33 countries during the 35 months that Kennedy was president, mostly funerals and ceremonies,
right.
And that just infuriated Johnson. And of course, we all know through Madeleine Brown's book that the evening before the assassination, he quietly whispered into Madeleine's ear that after tomorrow, those goddamn Kennedys will never embarrass me again. That's no threat. That's a promise. So we have a long history of Johnson's nefarious activities that lead up to this as being the culmination of his rise to power.
And there's that famous shot, that famous photograph of Johnson winking to his friend on the plane on Air Force One going back to Washington.
Yes.
And he's there taking the oath of the office of President of the United States, the blood-stained Jackie Kennedy standing next to him, and he turns to his friend and he winks. And that photograph is covered. I mean, it's just such a weird shot.
It is. And his friend there was Texas Congressman Albert Thomas. who was there as a witness to the swearing-in ceremony. And, yeah, it's clear Johnson's got a big smile. You can see the side of his face, and he's winking probably back at Albert Thomas, while Lady Bird is smiling. She can barely contain herself.
Yeah. Oh, it's so weird. And what were the run-up? As we'll get to a couple of calls here. And by the way, we were talking about you last week a little bit. Unholy Business is a book out about the faking of relics, religious relics in the Middle East, and it's all about how people do it and what the. It was really cool. But anyway, Nina Burley was the author, and she'd written a whole book about Cord Meyer's wife that your dad refers to in the. In the tape we played last hour.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She wrote a whole book back in 1998 about the mysterious murder of Mary Meyer. And so I mentioned you last week, and she said she wanted to come on for a few minutes and talk about that a little bit. Are you game for that?
Oh, I am so up for that, yes.
Okay, we'll get to that in a minute. What do you think your dad was doing in Miami? He makes reference to the run-up for the big event. What was that all about? What is that reference?
These were meetings held in various safe houses in and around Miami, where there was a pre-operation planning going on between some of the people that were recruiting some of the players in the assassination, and some of the people that had been given the responsibility for recruiting some of the people. So he was in attendance at several meetings with Dave Morales, who was a notorious CIA hitman. They gave Dave just about every dirty job that they could find, and Dave was up for it. He's he liked to get drunk and talk a lot, but he's also been noted to have possibly been at the scene of the RFK assassination. I don't know if that's true or not, but Dave Morales was there. Frank Sturgis, of course, was there. He was the go-between the CIA and the mob. He fought alongside Castro. You had people like Antonio Veciana that he founded Alpha 66, a very militant, violent group of anti-Castro Cuban exiles. They were planning and talking about the code name Big Event, which was in reference to the assassination of Kennedy. And I think they had it in mind that it was going to take place in Tampa. At some point it was moved to Dallas.
Here's what I read in the book Legacy of Secrecy, and we'll get to Lamar Waldron later on. But in Legacy of Secrecy, it says, and I think this is generally accepted wisdom, that the police were tipped off in Tampa.
Okay.
The word was out that there had been too much communication about this, and so the cat was out of the bag, so to speak. And as it turned out, it wasn't a safe environment. But we can ask about that a little bit later on. Now, your father would have been doing what specifically, do you think?
Well, he would have probably acted as a liaison between the higher ups at the CIA, like Dave Phillips and Cord Meyer and Bill Harvey, to probably handpick some of the people that were going to be actually doing some of the dirty work that day. Frank Sturgis, we know, drove a load of guns up from Miami to Dallas and met with my father a day or two before the assassination in Dallas. That's been testified by several people that saw my father there in Dallas and Frank as well. So I think my father was kind of the liaison, as he had served in many capacities, between the people on the street and the people in charge.
If your father's confession that we played, it doesn't – at no point does he preclude mafia involvement.
No, he doesn't. That's something that I wish we'd had a chance to talk about. He did talk to me about Jack Ruby's affiliation with the mob in Dallas as being I think the Dallas mob is kind of generally controlled by the New Orleans Carlos Marcello.
Right. Yeah, that's good. We'll definitely get to that coming up.
Yeah,
but even Jack Ruby, by some witnesses' accounts, was seen standing near the book depository in Dallas, which I thought was interesting, too. I don't know that I'd ever heard that before. I'm sure it's been out there, but I just never heard it. But your father, he never – I mean, for them to use mafioso types to actually pull the trigger or to be involved in an assassination, we know that had been going on already.
Well, that had been going on for many years, but here's something interesting. Bill Harvey, who was chief of station in Rome, and one of the people involved, according to my father, in the assassination of President Kennedy, there's a memo that has surfaced in recent times where Bill Harvey is he outlines the need for to use non-mafia, non-American mafia types for executive action planning and operations, and he suggests the use and his ability that he knows and can use members of the Corsican underworld. Of course, this is where the French Corsican gunman Lucien Sarti figures in, because he was a Corsican that probably was brought in by Harvey, you know, for the job.
That speaks to the mafia heroin connection.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah, sure. Yeah. There was that big Marseille in France and stuff.
Yeah, and there was a couple of the people that had actually gone by French names, too, which I thought was interesting in the book Legacy of Secrecy. Well, I want to grab a couple of calls here, and we'll get Nina Burley coming up about Mary Meyer, the mysterious death of Mary Meyer. And as that relates to the deathbed confession of E. Howard Hunt here in a few minutes, too. And I would actually really enjoy the opportunity of getting you together a little bit later on this hour with the author of Legacy of Secrecy to talk a little bit about your dad and his involvement. But before I take the first call here, just address again why you think your father gave you, of his many kids, right, a couple of different wives, gave you this tape?
Well, first of all, my father and I had developed this bond of secrecy years earlier during the break-in at the Watergate, the Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate office complex, when I was the only person at our home in Potomac, Maryland, that was there. When my father came home after his team had been arrested at the DNC, and I was the only person there that could help him with the destruction of evidence that he needed to do to kind of cover his ass for the next few days. So for the next few days, I helped my father transport large amounts of cash from banks, and I was watching my rearview mirror for being tailed by the FBI or the press, and I destroyed evidence. I destroyed a typewriter. And
yeah, you and your dad woke you up that night, didn't
you? Yeah, my dad woke me up that night and said, son, I need you to get dressed and come upstairs. Something's happened, and I need your help, and I need you to come up and help me. And it was like, here, I can redeem myself in my father's eyes. And so I helped him wipe down this electronic bugging equipment and tripods and cords and black boxes and thingamabobs that were in
there. Isn't that funny? You could redeem yourself in your father's eyes by participating in the destruction of evidence to a crime.
Isn't that something? Well, that's how probably low I felt about myself compared to what I knew my father had expected of his firstborn son to achieve.
Right.
You know, I felt like I was just a big disappointment. So to me, there was no choice in the matter. I leapt up and ran upstairs and said, "What can I do?"
Let's get to Richard. He's in Springfield, Massachusetts, on Coast to Coast AM for St. John Hunt and the book Bond of Secrecy. Richard.
Yes. Thank you very much for taking my call. I have a question about the five shots from about three or four different directions that was recorded. And the last two shots were simultaneous,
right?
One from the grassy knoll and the one from the front. Okay.
Well, I think your question might be better directed to St. John Hunt wasn't there. I mean, but we do have the author Legacy of Secrecy coming up, who does get into the shots and the locations and other stuff. But so I'm not sure where St. John Hunt is with this.
Well, I would just like you thought on that, because it's been recorded,
right,
and it's very good evidence.
Yeah, St. John Hunt, your thought on the number of shooters.
Well, it is very good evidence, and I think we have probably three shooters, one from the front, one from the book depository, and one from the Daltex building, and I think that's something that probably my father had set up in Dealey Plaza in the days prior to the shooting.
Dave is in Allentown, Pennsylvania, for St. John Hunt. Dave?
Good morning, Ian.
Morning.
Good morning, Mr. Hunt.
Good morning, sir.
How are you? I was wondering if your father had ever discussed with you or if you had heard mentioned any of Dorothy Kilgallen's involvement with the investigation.
Dorothy what? I'm sorry?
Dorothy Kilgallen, the famous Hollywood investigator who was found dead while after she interviewed Jack Ruby.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
She was on What's My Line.
Right.
She was
a famous panelist.
Also, if there's anyone out in Hollywood listening to this, they should make a film about her life and call it Dorothy, because it would make an excellent, excellent movie,
okay.
Biography about her.
Yeah, I'd rather they make a movie about my mother's life and call that Dorothy.
Yeah, the long-suffering wife of E. Howard Hunt, and what she went through for all of that. But that is interesting. I mean, there were all of these, I mean, these sort of all of these assassinations or all of these mysterious deaths that happen. It's just not out of the realm of possibility at all that these follow-up deaths had to have occurred in order to keep this from ever coming out.
Well, of course, the first death was Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right.
So you got to get him out of the way. And then the person that engineered that, Jack Ruby, had to be disposed of. And of course, he pled to the, to the investigative committee, please get me out of Dallas and I'll tell you everything you want to know. But they just, they didn't really want to hear the truth.
John is in Palm Springs, California for St. John Hunt, son of E. Howard Hunt. John, you heard that confession last hour. You have a question for St. John Hunt?
Well, I have some fleshing out of the story. You're right about the triangulation. I was a Civil Air Patrol cadet in the New Orleans Lakefront Airport Squadron under David Ferry. And about a year, year and a half before that, Oswald was there under Ferry.
Mm-hmm.
David Ferry was a hypnotist, and he hypnotized me. That might be a component on a training and a bringing along of a patsy, if you will.
All right, fair enough. Interesting. Well, time prevents us from getting into more of your story, John, but that is interesting, and I think you're going to really enjoy Legacy of Secrecy on the way, too. So, St. John Hunt, hang on. I want to get you on with Nina Burley, who wrote this book on Mary Meyer. Your father refers to Cord Meyer as being the central assassin here, or somebody who's right in the middle of this. And I want you to hear from her about her investigation into the life of the woman that your father references in the tape, who died mysteriously, probably because she knew too much.
Yeah.
And we'll get to that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Like I said, the JFK assassination show here on Coast to Coast, we're kind of coming across some new connections. In fact, I just got word that somebody else who's been on the show recently has an unusual JFK connection for an investigation they're doing. And I don't even want to mention it yet because I'm afraid it's going to sound too crazy. So I'll just hang on to that for the moment and get back to it later on. St. John Hunt, author of Bond of Secrecy. I want to introduce you to Nina Burley. She's the author of A Very Private Woman, The Life and Unsolved Murder of Presidential Mistress Mary Meyer. And Nina, this is St. John Hunt. St. John Hunt, this is Nina.
Nina, so nice to talk to you.
Likewise.
Okay, so we were talking about you last week, St. John, when I was interviewing Nina, because Nina talked about how the CIA, it was the CIA, wasn't it, that came in to get the documents after Mary?
Yeah, James Jesus Angleton, who was one of the great super spooks, one of the...
Right, he was chief of counterintelligence for the CIA.
Much written about, and just a legend of spookiness.
Mm-hmm.
And Ben Bradley, the editor of the Washington Post, actually confessed years later that he found Angleton in the house. So it's not just a rumor. I mean, a newsman actually walked in and caught him at it and handed him the diary.
Yes.
Of Mary Meyer.
The Mary Meyer diary, which has never been seen again.
Right.
I just found that so fascinating that, again, here you have Ben Bradlee toward the end of his life admits that there was destruction of evidence involved in a murder. Again, what would the CIA have to do with coming in and destroying evidence at Mary Meyer's place? E. Howard Hunt. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mary.
She knew a lot about the MK Ultra program that the CIA was involved in. The MK Ultra program where they were dosing people with LSD and doing all sorts of mind control experiments.
That's right.
And she knew because she was a pal of Timothy Leary. She kind of bounced around the intellectual scene in New York and Washington. And Leary was a part of the kind of cool artist scene in New York that she was a part of. And she dropped acid with him. And she probably knew about the CIA's involvement because her husband was involved in mind control stuff. Since he was part of the sort of CIA's intellectual covert ops program. And so the big, kind of conspiracy theory about this, at least from the left, is that she was like the Johnny Appleseed of acid and
yeah.
was taking it up into the White House. And Kennedy had spoken, one of the journalists, pals of Bradley's had told the National Enquirer in a revenge move against his wife and Bradley at some point that Mary had smoked pot with Kennedy in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this, and then, that was taken and run with by the LSD advocates or devotees in this country. And you can still find it, if you Google it up, Mary Meyer, LSD, JFK, this is why she had to go, because she knew this incredible secret that he was dosing on acid and was about to, like, sign away the country for world peace.
Yeah, and I think she also had a pretty strong idea that JFK was killed as a result of a conspiracy from within the government, and it wasn't just some random attack by a lone nut. I think she had traveled in all those circles, and she had to go.
Let me throw in this thought. I'm curious about this because. I don't know if you heard, Nina, we played the deathbed confession of E. Howard Hunt last hour.
And I would have loved to hear that. Unfortunately, it's 2:30 in New York, and I was
totally understand that. But what's interesting, he talks right away about Cord Meyer being the guy, the point man, and that Cord Meyer, had his motivation because of his wife Mary Meyer being
He was cuckolded. He was angry at JFK.
Yes.
Right. Exactly, that he was that Mary Meyer was one of JFK's favorite mistresses,
and he was jealous of her because he wanted to be one of JFK's favorites, and
right.
he wasn't. He was passed
really?
Over. He was passed over for appointments and things. They were rivals going all the way back to Yale. And
yes, to Yale. That's right.
Harvard.
They were.
Kennedy was Harvard, right? But they were part of the set, the New York upper crust. And they were rivals, and there were even articles like in kind of obscure magazines from the 1930s or 40s, I think, where there's like rising stars in the on the American scene, young rising stars, and there's Cord Meyer with his his glass eye, which he gave to his country, which he was blown up on one of the Pacific Asian islands and lost an eye. And then on the other page, there's JFK, handsome, smiling, devil may care. And here's Cord, the sort of dark and brooding guy who's heading something called the World Federalist Organization, which at that time, right after World War II, there was this movement to have a one world government. It was kind of came out of he was also involved in the founding of the UN. And he wanted to, he had this notion that, if we don't all get together, the atomic bomb is going to destroy humanity.
Right.
And so this was a reaction to the A-bomb. And all through the country, young people kind of signed on to this movement. And he was the leader. He was the young, veteran leader,
right.
face of this movement. And there were posters of him up in colleges and stuff. Well, anyway, then he ended up being recruited to the CIA, and he had to go, his career plans had to go into the, into the darkness. Nobody, he was thought might be a diplomat or something or in politics, but instead he was in this secret organization.
Sure.
That at that time there wasn't even, there was just a barracks on, you know, K Street or something. It wasn't even an open, nobody knew it even existed.
Right.
And then here's Kennedy rising through the ranks.
Oh, yeah.
So
right.
There was definitely some
bad blood between them.
On the Cord Meyer side.
St. John, can I ask you, did your, other than that reference in his deathbed confession about Mary Meyer, did he ever talk about her in any other context or about her death in any way?
Well, he did. We spent an afternoon where he was talking about this sort of a side, this offshoot of the death of Kennedy, which involved Mary Meyer and Cord Meyer, because I had never heard the name Cord Meyer before, so my dad was kind of filling me in on who Cord was, and chief of station in Great Britain, and, you know, head of this sort of this CIA front for world. I can't remember what the term he used anyways, but he was telling me about Mary Meyer and her death and the fact that that he knew for a fact that James Jesus Angleton, the head of counterintelligence for the CIA for many, many years, whose job was to root out the double agents and the deep moles by the Soviets that had been planted in the CIA, Nosenko and people like that, he had broken into Mary Meyer's apartment with two agents from the CIA to ransack and steal her diary, and that Ben Bradley ended up with the diary, and he felt that she was definitely killed as a result of her knowledge of the conspiracy.
Of the conspiracy to kill JFK.
Yes, among many other inside information that she had. I mean, it's very similar to Marilyn Monroe. Here she kept a diary. She was sleeping with JFK, just like Mary Meyer was. And, you know, her death happened, and her diary was stolen, too.
Your dad knew nothing about the death of Marilyn Monroe.
No, he never spoke to me about that, but I'm just drawing a parallel.
Sure.
You know.
No, I was just double checking to make sure.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Nina. I just thought it was so interesting. A very private woman, the life and unsolved murder of presidential mistress Mary Meyer, who was what, walking down one of the canal streets in Washington when she was
on the towpath and shot in the head.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, they did actually arrest a black man for that who had been fishing, and I don't know if he was acquitted or not. Do you know, Nina?
Oh yeah, he was acquitted by an all black jury. He had a fantastic female criminal defense lawyer who was also an Episcopalian preacher, and she got him off. There was some compelling evidence in his direction, though. I mean, I investigated after he got off. First of all,
yeah.
He never found the murder weapon, but after he got off. He spent his life, he's still alive, I think, or was at least when I was writing the book, he spent his life doing all sorts of heinous things, but getting away with it because it was in this complete underclass, and he was in and out of federal prison for arson and rape.
Oh, wow.
So he definitely had, he was kind of a bad dude, and,
yeah.
Some people think maybe he was, you know, working for the government and our court or I don't know, but you know, I don't definitively answer who did it.
Right.
Sure.
Right. Is your book published?
Oh yes, back in 1999.
98. A very 98. Private woman came out in 98. My new book, Unholy Business, was out recently, and that's the one Ian and I talked about last week.
Well,
and that's how I got.
If you know a good literary agent, please turn me on to one someone that can help me publish my book.
she's very good. A Very Private Woman, The Life and Unsolved Murder of Presidential Mistress Mary Meyer. Thank you, Nina Burley. Look forward to chatting with you again sometime.
You're welcome, Ian. Take care.
Thank you, Nina.
Bye-bye.
Have a good night. St. John Hunt, too, we've been talking about your dad, and as I said, I was really interested in the book Legacy of Secrecy, which is out now. It's selling very well. Author Lamar Waldron is here, and I thought I'd bring him on just a few minutes early to talk with you, too. Lamar, how are you this evening?
Doing quite well. I'm here in Dallas. Left my usual home in Atlanta to come to the JFK Lancer Conference. I'm here at the Adolphus Hotel, which sits across from the old location of Jack Ruby's nightclub here in Dallas.
Sure. How about that? Well, this is St. John Hunt, the son of E. Howard Hunt, on the phone with us, too.
Well, very nice to talk to you. Do you go by St. John?
I do go by St. John, sir.
Nice to talk to you. I've studied your father since about 1988 and have a lot of brand new information about him and Legacy of Secrecy.
Oh, well, I'll have to pick up a copy or something. Yeah.
Well, why don't you just let him know right now some of the things, Lamar, that you found out? Because I on the index, it's about a quarter of a page of references in the back to,
well,
say, to E. Howard Hunt.
I'll focus on the things that Hunt left out of his own autobiography and that he left out of the tape that he prepared for St. John. Probably the two biggest things are the coup plan that E. Howard Hunt had a major, major role in, where John and Robert Kennedy were going to overthrow Fidel Castro on December the 1st, 1963, 10 days after Dallas. And they were using the number three man in the Cuban government, the head of the Cuban army, Commander Juan Almeida. The CIA part of the plan was called AM World, a code name and term that had never appeared in print anywhere in any government report or book or magazine outside of the CIA until the publication of our first book, Ultimate Sacrifice, back in 2005. E. Howard Hunt played a very, very major role for the CIA in AM World and that coup plan that he pretty much ignored and never wrote about in his own book and left out of his tape. The other thing that E. Howard Hunt left out of what he wrote and said were the mafia ties of several of his very close associates.
Uh-huh.
Most notable, his best friend, Manuel Arteme.
Oh, yes.
A great hero of the Bay of Pigs.
Oh, yes.
And a lot of people know Manuel Arteme. Well, unfortunately, Manuel Arteme, as we also revealed in Ultimate Sacrifice and have so much more information in Legacy of Secrecy, was tied into the mafia, specifically Tampa Godfather Santo Trafficante, and drug dealing.
Uh-huh, of course.
So, and the CIA was using Manuel Arteme in their plots with the mafia,
yes,
separate from the Kennedys, to try and kill Fidel Castro. So,
yes,
E. Howard Hunt was very close to Arteme, who died rather suddenly back in the 1970s,
yes,
not long after congressional investigators had contacted Mr.
Yeah.
Arteme.
We used to call, well, we knew him as Manolo because we were, my father, as you very well said, was very close to Manolo. He was to have been the future president of Cuba had the assassination of Castro and the successful Bay of Pigs been carried out successfully. That didn't happen. And, Manolo was a great guy. He was very gregarious, very warm, and I remember many, many dinners with him and his wonderful wife. I'm still in touch with his children. We're longtime friends and of the Artemes. He was my my brother David's godfather. When my brother David was kidnapped from our house after my father was in prison and my mom was murdered, William F. Buckley sent a couple of his guys to take my brother and send him to Miami to live with the Artemis. So he grew up in the Arteme family, and I have nothing but great things to say about Manolo, and I know that he was involved in a lot of things that people don't. I mean, he's not a name that's generally well known. Would you agree?
Right. Most people really outside of the Cuban community don't recognize his name, and I think everything St. John that you just talked about helps to explain why E. Howard Hunt, even years after Arteme's rather sudden death,
yes,
before he could testify, I think people don't realize people can be close to someone like that and then their family and then their children. And so E. Howard Hunt, while he was alive, in at least in what he recorded and what he wrote, he left out the mafia ties of Manuel Arteme, which are very important in looking at the Kennedy story, because the congressional investigators wanted to talk to Arteme.
Right.
Because they had been told that he had, quote, guilty knowledge of the assassination,
yes,
unquote.
Now Arteme was figured very significantly in a very limited edition publishing of a book my father wrote called "Give Us This Day." Have you ever read that?
Oh yeah, I've definitely read that. And
yeah, it's got a lot of great photographs of Arteme and my father training the Exile Brigade 2506. Who, by the way, when my father passed away and I went down to his memorial service, Bernie Barker, I'm sure you know that who that is, was there, and Felix Rodriguez was there, and they gave my father positive posthumously a flag of the brigade.
All right, hang on just a second, and we'll get back to Lamar Waldron. St. John Hunt, as always, I enjoyed this. I hope you, I wish you huge success with Bond of Secrecy. It should be out in a form where people could stop by a bookstore and grab it. In the meantime, you can ebook it. You can link up to that through coasttocoastam.com. And I hope you keep on listening, because we're going to talk a little bit more about your dad and the whole, all of the new information in Legacy of Secrecy, Lamar Waldron, next on Coast to Coast AM. You know, it's so interesting, this theme of who's lying and who's telling the truth and when do they decide to tell the truth. It's kind of been weaving throughout this show from the very beginning. As you mentioned, you know, Gerald R. Ford, years before, a couple years before he passed on, wrote in a foreword to the new edition of the Warren Commission that's out that, yes, in fact, the CIA had destroyed documents after the assassination of JFK. Had never admitted that publicly before, but put that in the foreword to this new edition. It's a signed copy, and you can get that. It was sort of saved for listeners of Coast to Coast, and you can link up to it through the website. Then you have the deathbed confession of E. Howard Hunt, and then you have Ben Bradley, too, who had mentioned before he died that, yes, in fact, he had handed over the diary of Mary Meyer to a CIA agent that was inside of Mary Meyer's home, the wife of Cord Meyer, the man identified by E. Howard Hunt as being one of the key players in the assassination of JFK. And Ben Bradley himself, the former, you know, editor-in-chief of the Washington Post, handing over the diary to the CIA so that essentially they could go destroy it. And feeling bad about it later in life. It's sort of a, what was I thinking, kind of a moment at the time, caught up in patriotism or duty or something, did that. And then you have the deathbed confessions of a variety of mafioso who, toward the end of their lives, confessed on tape to the FBI, even, their involvement in the death of JFK. And that is core to the book Legacy of Secrecy. We'll get back with Lamar Waldron next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Lamar Waldron co-authored the book Legacy of Secrecy with Tom Hartman. You all have been working together before, and you do some really nice research here on this book. I don't have to tell you that. It's very thick, very detailed, and it's backed up through lots of footnotes and attributions, and some very original work, too, as you continue to uncover the truth behind who was involved in the assassination of JFK. So thanks for coming on a little bit early with E. Howard Hunt's kid, St. John Hunt. Wasn't that interesting?
Oh, very, very good to talk with him.
And you had heard the confession, the taped confession of E. Howard Hunt. You reference it. What do you hear in that tape when you hear him making this confession before the end of his life about what he did? How do you reconcile that with the other confessions that are coming out?
Well, you have to evaluate anyone's confession, whether it's E. Howard Hunt or Carlos Marcello or a gentleman by the name of Chauncey Holt, who tried to confess in the early 90s that Tom and I spoke to and decided was a fraud. And luckily, my background's in psychology. My master's is in counseling and psychology, and I had 7 years of criminal justice experience. And so, you know, you have to know what's what there. And so what you're looking for is there independent corroboration of what they're saying? Are they consistent in what they say? Is what they say consistent with the known facts? Are they saying something for money or attention? You know, and unfortunately, in the case of E. Howard Hunt, he had been trying to obtain several million dollars from Kevin Costner's film production company.
Right.
And so, you know, what it looks like with E. Howard, and of course, what E. Howard Hunt says in the tape is different somewhat than what he said in his autobiography,
mm-hmm.
different than what he had said in earlier interviews.
Right.
And he left the mafia pretty much completely out of all of those versions, despite the fact, as I mentioned to his son, that several of his closest associates were not only tied to the mafia, but were tied to the JFK assassination. So what it appears is that Mr. Hunt was, A, trying to make money in a way that you know, couldn't send him to prison, because remember, there's no statute of limitations on murder.
Exactly.
And even if you don't pull the trigger, there are, you know, surrounding circumstances as accomplice and conspiracy.
Yep.
And, you know, trying to get money, maybe get a little out, but, you know, is he trying to get a little of the truth out, or is he trying to muddy the waters so that the memories of his best friend and still friends with the families, you know, the surviving family of people like Manuel are Artime? So no one really saw anything new in the Hunt confession because there were several inconsistencies, inaccuracies. And, you know, he had Frank Sturgis, who in the early 60s went by the name of Frank Fiorini, kind of a soldier of fortune type. He had him, you know, doing stuff with the CIA relative to the plot that Sturgis Fiorini wasn't, you know, in that position. I mean, he was like an informant for the CIA. So it looks like he tried to cobble together some things he had pulled from various sources, you know, in a way that he could make some money without really harming any of his friends or his friends', you know, memories. And, you know, and maybe his motive was to provide for his family.
I would disagree with that because, and here's why, and I think your point is taken and I appreciate that, but when he sends the tape to his son and says, this is for after when I'm dead, and he doesn't really preserve a lot of his friends. In fact, he really names names to say Cord Meyer was involved and to be talking about Morales. I mean, he actually comes out and says these people. And at the time, Cord Meyer was still being thought of, at least in proper CIA circles, as a hero of the Central Intelligence Agency. I think that there's no way you could make money in a deathbed confession if you're saying this should come out until, you know, after I'm dead.
Well, but we have to look at all the circumstance, which is something Tom and I learned years ago. You know, it's like people used to say about the Kennedy assassination. If you find out who controlled the cover-up, you'll find out who did the crime. Well, that turned out to be wrong because Bobby Kennedy was a major part of the cover-up, and he controlled the autopsy. So, but what we found was, oh, wait a minute, there are other reasons Bobby Kennedy would have covered up aside from that. In the case of Hunt, you know, Cord Meyer, the rumors about Cord Meyer and the assassination and the assassination community in that field, I mean, they go back decades for those very reasons. And there's no evidence. So people had been looking at Cord Meyer, looking for evidence that Cord Meyer had been involved. Tom and I, when we first got into this back in 1988, you know, we looked at all these things. We looked at E. Howard Hunt. Was E. Howard Hunt on the grassy knoll? Was he in Dealey Plaza? We looked at Cord Meyer. So these things have been investigated. But see, he did leave out, you know, and while Hunt knew Cord Meyer, knew David Morales, he wasn't friends with those like he was with others, including Manuel Artime. So he's giving a very partial version that again, his most of which has been out there before. And again, he leaves out the big secret things that he did know. And of course, yes, he says he's recording this and it should only be able to be done after his death. I think the earliest recording date I see is like 2004. And yet, around that same time, he's negotiating with Kevin Costner's production company, you know, saying that I'll tell you everything for, you know, for millions of dollars. So, you know, so again, it really, you know, it really muddies the water, and there's really no, you know, there's really no evidence to back up what he's saying. And like I say, he's inconsistent. Do we believe what's in the autobiography or in the tape? And even in the tapes, he sort of contradicts himself at the time and says he's speculating. You know, well, it must have been this person, must have been that person.
Right.
And believe me, Hunt knew things he could have said in that tape or told his son or put in his autobiography that would have stunned everybody, but they would have kind of opened a can of worms about some of his very close associates and perhaps himself. He did not want to go there. E. Howard Hunt, I'm completely convinced, knew about the attempt to assassinate JFK in Tampa, Florida, four days before Dallas, that Tom and I uncovered and first wrote about in Ultimate Sacrifice. We have more about it in Legacy of Secrecy.
Yes, you do.
And that was covered up by John and Robert Kennedy. You know, talk about cover-ups. They covered up this assassination attempt in a motorcade in Tampa 4 days before Dallas. And the CIA, you know, was aware of that. E. Howard Hunt had such a big role with that upcoming coup plan, and that factored into JFK's decision to go through with that motorcade, even though JFK had been told, you know, there was a potential two gunmen out there that were going to shoot him because JFK had to give a speech in Miami that night with words written for Commander Almeida. So JFK couldn't very well cancel his motorcade, look cowardly, and then give a speech that's designed with, you know, wording to encourage somebody else to risk their life.
Their life, too.
You know, so E. Howard Hunt knew about that. E. Howard Hunt knew about Commander Almeida. E. Howard Hunt was intimately involved, get this, with, and this is in Legacy of Secrecy for the first time, but we've had this on tape since 1992 from a close aide of Bobby Kennedy. E. Howard Hunt was helping with the operation that got Commander Almeida's wife and two sons out of Cuba prior to the coup date, not as a defection, but on some sort of a pretext, you know, so that it looked like they had to leave Cuba for a while. This was
right.
to get them out of the country, you know, during the coup, so they wouldn't be killed. Now, the interesting thing is they apparently, from all reports, never went back to Cuba full time to live. Today, Commander Almeida is still number three in Cuba, and yet his sons are successful businessmen in Madrid and in Mexico with businesses that may well have been started from the money that the CIA, initially under E. Howard Hunt, was sending them starting back in 1963. In other words, there's so much secret stuff that started in 63 that in many ways has still never resolved itself. So like I say, I take E. Howard Hunt's confession with a big grain of salt because 90% of it seems recycled from stuff that has already been investigated. For the other 10%, there is no independent corroborating evidence. And what I find interesting is what we know about Hunt that he did not say. You know,
right.
those are the things he didn't want us to know about. So then we should ask, well, why didn't he want us to know about that?
Well, and I think your point about going to prison is relevant, too, that there would have been, even as an elderly man, he would have had to have endured a trial. He would have had to have gone through the humiliation of, you know, seeing his name dragged about in a way which he seemed too vain to even go with. But I want to back up a little bit to what you're talking about so that people understand. Again, we're talking about the book Legacy of Secrecy. In these new details, let's talk about that assassination attempt in Tampa. And that, as you said, Bobby and JFK both covered that up. Talk about that.
Well, that was actually the second attempt in November of 63. The first had been in Chicago on November the 2nd. A gentleman who's actually visiting here in Dallas, Abraham Bolden, the first black presidential Secret Service agent, was part of the Secret Service group in Chicago that dealt with that threat. There were four gunmen, two may have been detained and released. There was an ex-Marine who had a lot of interesting similarities to Lee Harvey Oswald, who was arrested with a carload of weaponry and ammunition. So it just looked so dangerous that JFK had to cancel his motorcade at the last minute, angering Mayor Daley at the time, even as people were lining the motorcade route. And poor Pierre Salinger, JFK's press secretary, who's one of the people that talked to me about this, you know, had to issue two different phony excuses within like half an hour. But they kept the lid on it. Newsmen didn't know about the threat, but they were told and complied. They kept it out of the papers. Okay, so they kept that covered up. And so then flash ahead to November the 18th, JFK's longest motorcade of his presidency, in Tampa, Florida. Now, the Kennedys were waging a huge war against the mafia at that time because the mafia had been able to run free basically during the 1950s under Vice President Richard Nixon. And in fact, Nixon and E. Howard Hunt had basically been heavily involved in Cuban operations prior to the 1960 election and the months before when the mafia was basically hired by the CIA to kill Castro. That was going to be the original October surprise that would elect Nixon president over JFK. Did not work. The CIA kept working with the mafia without telling the Kennedys, and that caused problems for the Kennedys. So by November of 63, the Kennedys had their own plan to get rid of Fidel. They didn't need the mafia. The CIA only had a supporting role, but Richard Helms, E. Howard Hunt's mentor, at that time about the number four official in the CIA, but the main official for operations, official title was Deputy Director for Plans, he was continuing to use the mafia as kind of a backup plan. Well, unfortunately, the Kennedys, they had banned the mafia from the coup plan. The mafia was banned from reopening their casinos after the coup. The Kennedys' goal was a free and democratic Cuba without the mafia. But because the CIA was still dealing with the mafia, some mobsters were able to infiltrate the Kennedys' secret coup plan. Now, the three mob families under the most pressure from the Kennedys in the fall of 63 were the Chicago Mafia family, the Tampa godfather Santo Traficante, and Carlos Marcello, the godfather of Louisiana and most of Texas, including Dallas. His territory stretched through a lot of the Southeast. So what we discovered, and this can be well documented, and we have a lot about it in Legacy of Secrecy, is that so you had these three mafia families under pressure. So you had one attempt in Chicago, the motorcade's called off. You have another attempt in Tampa, and JFK and the authorities find out about that attempt, that plot. JFK is advised by the chief of police, who told me about this, to cancel this motorcade. But JFK knew, you know, you can't go around canceling motorcades at the last minute and issuing phony excuses and expect to get away with it. Plus, it would look horrible to Commander Almeida, who's supposed to risk his life. And so JFK quite bravely went ahead with that motorcade. Jackie Kennedy was not with him, as she was in Dallas. But Traficante had a man on the Tampa police force. We name him in the book for the first time because he recently died, Sergeant Jack De La Lana, head of the Tampa Police Intelligence Unit, was actually working for Santo Traficante for decades while he was on the Tampa police force. And so he found out the authorities knew, tipped Traficante. Traficante called off the hit. But again, the press kept this out of the papers. Members of the press knew about it, some, but they didn't, not a word about it appeared while JFK was alive. So when we talk about cover-ups, you know, the cover-ups of the JFK assassination began before JFK was assassinated with Chicago and Tampa. So basically the mob's main plan, Chicago, had a backup plan, Tampa, but even their backup plan had a backup, and that was Dallas. So,
no, please go ahead. I didn't realize
that. Well, I was going to say, and there's so many similarities between the Tampa plot and the Dallas plot. If people go to the old Floridan Hotel in Tampa and look at it, it looks like a bigger version of the Texas School Book Depository. The intersection where they were going to shoot JFK is about the same distance from that hotel as where the fatal headshot was fired in Dallas. So there weren't three separate plans. There was one plan in three different cities, and it eventually succeeded in Dallas.
You do this research beautifully, and I want to get into this throughout the course of the evening, but let me ask you to put yourself in the mind of Jackie Kennedy. She makes the comment afterwards about they finally got him, or they. She was referring to plural. Who do you think she was referring to? What do you think had either JFK had told her or that she knew about the assassination attempts?
Well, see, she would have been aware, at least going back to Chicago, you know, 3 weeks before Dallas, that you know, there were these threats. She would have known about that. In fact, as we write in the book, JFK, the night before the assassination in Dallas, he is modeling in the hotel suite in Fort Worth how he's talking about how easy it would have been for someone to kill him, and he even goes through the motions of how somebody could come up and shoot him, actually kind of mimicking the way Jack Ruby shot Lee Harvey Oswald. So because of these threats that Jackie Kennedy knew about, in other words, so she knew this didn't come out of the blue. Now, I have to say, in Dallas, see, there was no active threat as there had been in Chicago or in Tampa.
We're coming down to the bottom of the hour, and I just want to, who do you think she thought they were? What do you, in her mind, was she thinking mafia, CIA? What do you think she was thinking they were?
She could have even been thinking beyond that. I mean, Jimmy Hoffa was certainly, you know, a hated enemy of the Kennedys, and the Kennedys knew that he had thought about killing Bobby the summer before. So when we come back, we'll talk about what Bobby knew about who killed his brother.
Okay, good. That's perfect. And it really is. It's just I dog-eared a bunch of pages, Lamar, and I was going through it. I'm going, okay, got to ask about this. I got to ask about that.
I will answer every single question. No one's ever been able to ask me a question about the assassination I haven't been able to answer. But
I have no doubt about that.
First.
I have no. I have absolutely no doubt about that. Incredibly detailed book. It's just out. Legacy of Secrecy: The Long Shadow of the JFK Assassination. Talk about crossing your T's and dotting your I's. Great work on this, Lamar Waldron and Tom Hartman. Lamar continues with us. We'll open up the phones for you coming up next hour. I've got too many questions to get to first on our annual JFK Assassination Show on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Lamar Waldron, co-author of Legacy of Secrecy. And so let's talk about what the Bobby JFK connection is. Just for people who are tuning in, you have a very specific line of thought that follows, I think, very logically, that one of the reasons why this all gets very muddied right away after the assassination of JFK was that there were big plans coming 10 days later on December 1st to invade Cuba. Or to be a part of, at least passively, part of a coup in Cuba to assassinate Fidel Castro and take the country back over again.
Right. And this goes to the heart of what Bobby believed, who he believed within hours had killed JFK, is because the head of the Cuban army, as we talked about, was going to lead the coup. And he was going to ensure that Fidel was killed. He wasn't going to take responsibility, because why would the people of Cuba, even though he was a beloved leader, Commander Almeida, why would they follow him if their other beloved leader, Fidel, had been killed? So from the research we've done, it appears that the death of Fidel would be blamed on a Russian or a Russian sympathizer. And you see, that way the Russian people would turn against all those thousands of Russian troops. Commander Almeida would form a coalition government with a handful of selected Cuban exile leaders, including Manuel Artime, whom we talked about earlier, and that would eventually lead to democracy, but it would never be known. It's supposed to never be known, not a month later, not a year later, not 2 years later. It's supposed to never be known by anyone that the Kennedys and Almeida had really killed Fidel. Now, Fidel was going to be killed in an open car by rifle fire. That's from CIA files that have been declassified now. And so imagine you're Bobby Kennedy on November the 22nd. You've had these scares in Chicago and in Tampa, but no active threats in Dallas. Everybody's relaxed. You know, the Secret Service agents in Dallas, some of them went out drinking until 6 a.m., blowing off steam. Yeah, they shouldn't have done that, but, you know, they had been under a lot of pressure in recent weeks. But imagine you're Bobby Kennedy. It's your pool. It's your Hickory Hill estate in Virginia near Washington. And you hear that JFK has just been killed in the way that you've been planning for Fidel Castro to be killed. And which is, again, one reason JFK had to be killed in public and not just poisoned while he was with some mistress, which right. If you think about it, would have been a lot easier and simpler, and you and I would be having this conversation. But no, it was necessary for him not only to be killed in public, but to be killed that way, because that sent a chilling message immediately to Bobby Kennedy. Well, the first suspicion we have about Bobby
Kennedy. Wait, stop right there. And it's a message sent by whom? Who would have been trying to, just to make very clear, who was trying to chill Bobby Kennedy?
Well, the people whose backs he had against the wall, and they had no choice. Bobby had been prosecuting Carlos Marcello. Again, we've got these three mafia families, Roselli of the Chicago Mafia, Trafficante, and Carlos Marcello. And Marcello had been on trial all November in New Orleans by Bobby's federal prosecutors, had only gotten off by bribing a juror. In fact, Marcello ensured his bribed juror, you know, got him an acquittal, so that Marcello's victory celebration on November 22nd was planned so he could actually celebrate JFK's murder. Trafficante celebrated in Tampa that night at the very restaurant where JFK had given a speech 4 days earlier. So these mobsters had no choice. I mean, they couldn't go back to Cuba. Their backs were against the wall. The New York Times, the week of the assassination, had a series of articles leaked by Bobby Kennedy that the Justice Department under Bobby was getting ready to go into Las Vegas to run the mafia out of Las Vegas. Where did they have left to go? They had no place to go. Marcello and Roselli weren't even citizens, you know, so they could be deported. So these mobsters had no choice. They took this action by infiltrating that coup plan and using parts of it, even the bullets in Oswald's rifle, to kill JFK in a way that would force Bobby Kennedy to work with his hated enemies, LBJ and J. Edgar Hoover, to cover stuff up, not to protect Marcello, but to prevent World War III, because this is just a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis. If all of this had come out then, you know, we could have had another confrontation with the Soviets.
Sure.
So Bobby Kennedy realized this so well. 3 hours after JFK is pronounced dead, Bobby Kennedy is on the phone to a hotel in Washington. He talks to his number one Cuban exile aide, Harry Enrique Ruiz Williams, who was one of our biggest sources. Harry Williams, as he liked to be called, was going to be one of the people, along with Manuel Artemi, who would be in that new government.
Right.
Now, Harry Williams mentions to Bobby, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, Haynes Johnson, is in the room with him. Bobby says, let me speak to Haynes. Haynes Johnson was writing a book with Manuel Artemi at the time. Bobby Kennedy on the phone to Haynes Johnson. Haynes Johnson's written about this. We've talked to him about it. There's no question. Bobby Kennedy tells Haynes Johnson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, 3 hours after the assassination, one of your guys did it. And we feel that that was a reference to Manuel Artemi or one of Artemi's associates. So Bobby knew right off the bat, hey, this big secret plan that could trigger World War III, somebody got to it and used the same way we were going to kill Fidel to kill my brother.
And that does sound like the kind of mafia irony. It would seem consistent with the way the mafia thinks. Let me get you, though, if I can, to make something clear that's rumbling around in my head then.
Sure.
That you know, just going about this, again, going back to the E. Howard Hunt confession or with other books that have been written that said that there was a rogue operation within the CIA, as I understood it, and please feel free to take this apart, this rogue operation of CIA agents and or operatives, this theory is that they are still angry with JFK over the Bay of Pigs. They see him as an impediment toward further military involvement around the world. They feel that for both the good of the country, for, you know, for mom and apple pie, they have to kill JFK. And that JFK was keeping them from being able to get rid of Fidel Castro, that he was soft on Castro. That wouldn't be consistent at all, though, with your understanding that there was going to be 10 days after the JFK assassination, there was already a planned coup that involved the CIA, that the CIA was involved with the dethroning, so to speak, of Fidel Castro and the installation of a popular military leader in a pro-U.S. government that was scheduled to happen 10 days after JFK. Would that be
exactly right? And that is why there's really no evidence that the highest CIA officials, the CIA director, John McCone, appointed by Bobby, and even really Richard Helms, who's the highest operations official, so to speak, there's really no evidence they were involved in the assassination, and they had no motivation because,
right.
I mean, they wanted to see this go forward, that the CIA would get this huge new playground in Cuba. They only had a supporting role in the coup plan. The military had the leading role, but still, that would be a great thing for them if this happened. So the highest officials had no motivation, or if they were going to kill JFK, hey, wait till after the coup. If it works, fine. If it fails, we'll blame it on JFK and, you know, run him out of office. Here's the important thing.
Okay.
But remember, Richard Helms is running as kind of a backup plan. He's still using Johnny Roselli in his own kind of CIA mafia plots to kill Fidel Castro. Again, kind of as I'm sure he rationalized it as a backup. What if something happened to Commander Almeida? Well, if I've got mafia guys that can shoot Fidel in an open, you know, Jeep when he's going to his beach house at Paradero Beach, you know, we can still go forward. You know, but Johnny Roselli wasn't interested in killing Fidel Castro. All the meetings Roselli would have with people like Jack Ruby in Miami that fall that Richard Helms and most CIA officials would think, well, this is about, you know, our little backup plan we're keeping secret from the Kennedys. You know, Roselli and Ruby were really talking about killing JFK. But so there were lower-level CIA officials, the highest that I think there's pretty wide agreement on and a confession that I view credibly, given the circumstances, is that of David Morales, the operations chief at the Miami CIA station. you know, a huge CIA station. The CIA is not even supposed to run operations in the U.S. This is a huge CIA station. Morales, you know, at that time is a pretty powerful official down there. And he later confessed to not only JFK's murder, but also Bobby's. So yeah, David, and see, David Morales did not have a big role in the JFK Almeida coup plan like E. Howard Hunt did. He only had a very small supporting role. So it's very easy to see why David Morales, who was very angry over the Bay of Pigs and was very close to Johnny Roselli, was friends with Johnny Roselli, would work with Roselli to kill JFK. We name and indicate other CIA people in the book. The other thing we point out is even Marcello himself and Trafficante and Roselli, all the dozen CIA type, I'm sorry, mafia types knowingly involved in the assassination, all had intelligence ties. They were all CIA or naval intelligence or other intelligence informants, assets, agents, or officers.
Right. So I'm going to step aside here again. So just let me make sure I understand this. So I would have thought, though, that the assassination of JFK would have interfered with the disposal of Fidel Castro 10 days later. That for people who were interested in getting rid of Fidel Castro would have seen the assassination of JFK as an impediment to that.
Well, see, you're exactly right, which is why the mafia bosses, like Marcello, they didn't care. In other words, they had to get rid of JFK to end Bobby's prosecution of them. So Cuba or not, that was irrelevant. They were going to go to jail. So they had to do it. The high CIA officials, you're exactly right. That's why they weren't involved. Now, someone on the level of David Morales.
Right.
You know, he, you know, and again, even Morales knew about the secret negotiations that weren't working, that, you know, the peace negotiations between JFK and Castro. But you know, David Morales had seen stuff screw up at the Bay of Pigs. He had lost men there. He was a ruthless, brutal guy. Even the CIA people admit that. So that's why it's easy to see him involved. And there's some others, again, associates of E. Howard Hunt, who were also, you know, knowingly involved, and some of them confessed, like John Martino, who we have in newspaper articles and FBI files talking about JFK's invasion plan, flaunting his knowledge to the FBI because he knows the FBI can't do a darn thing to him because this whole thing is just so incredibly secret. So
I'm going to ask you again. Sure. I know it's harder for you because all these things connect beautifully, but honestly, I want to make sure that I stay pretty close to a thread so it's easy to follow for the uninitiated. And I appreciate your patience with me on this. But let me back up again for just a moment and say then, what were the deathbed confessions of Roselli? What did Roselli tell the FBI? What did Marcello or Marcello tell the FBI? What did they confess to their exact roles in this that you base the book Legacy of Secrecy on?
Well, first off, Bobby Kennedy did his own secret investigations, and we eventually talked to more than two dozen people who worked with John and Robert Kennedy. And Bobby did his own secret investigations that are outlined in the book. We talked to the only – but see, even when somebody secretly investigated for Bobby, Bobby couldn't tell those people about the coup plan. Only one of the secret investigators knew. And that gentleman told us that you know, it was Marcello, Trafficante, and Roselli. So we didn't pull this out of the air.
Sure.
You know, this came from people that worked with John and Bobby Kennedy. And so – but it is interesting. There is an awful lot of evidence in these confessions. Johnny Roselli confessed to his attorney shortly before his own death that Johnny Roselli had spread a lot of phony stories that had been part of the plan, trying to blame Fidel Castro for the assassination. Because, hey, the mob guys knew this invasion was about to happen. And if you pointed phony clues and Fair Play for Cuba Committee Oswald type, you know, maybe the invasion will just go ahead and happen. And, hey, once JFK is gone, then it might be good for the mafia to be back in Cuba. So Johnny Roselli confessed to his attorney, that's often overlooked, that he had a knowing role in JFK's murder. Not much detail, but then again, Johnny Roselli was killed not long after that in a murder linked to Senator Trafficante before he could testify again to Congress, and he was found, you know, cut up in an oil drum floating in a canal down in Miami. Senator Trafficante confessed to his attorney that he shared with Jimmy Hoffa, a guy by the name of Frank Regano, very shortly before his death, what we have new in Legacy of Secrecy are FBI files showing that Frank Regano had a much bigger role in the assassination, especially a payoff of $200,000, than Regano ever admitted in his lifetime. And but the most I'd say detailed confession is the one that we have is from Carlos Marcello that we have for the first time in uncensored form in the book. This comes from 1985, 4 years before Marcello had a debilitating stroke. Marcello was old at the time, but in speaking with the lead FBI agent on that case, you know, he said he didn't notice any signs of the Alzheimer's that would later plague Marcello. And all the things Marcello said, you know, basically check out, and there's independent corroboration for it. I'll read you what Marcello, this is what Marcello told a reliable FBI informant in prison. This is in the prison yard, but in front of a witness. Now, Marcello is saying this to two very, very trusted associates, okay? And the informant who gave this information to the FBI was found reliable by a federal judge to be so reliable that they had this incredible bugging operation they then authorized. So here's what Marcello said, some of what he said. He said Marcello was ranting about the Kennedys, ranting about JFK, and he said, yeah, I had the SOB killed, and I would do it again. He was a thorn in my side. I wish I could have done it myself. And in another conversation, Marcello admitted meeting Jack Ruby, saying that David Ferry brought Lee Harvey Oswald to meet him on several occasions. Marcello admitted setting up Jack Ruby and the bar business in Dallas, and Ruby was kind of the payoff man for the Dallas police, would come over and make regular reports to Marcello. There's like 100 pages of these files, and there was this incredible bugging operation that generated hundreds of hours of tapes that your listeners are hearing about for the first time. Exactly how much about the assassinations on the tapes, hard to say, but we have these other reports that the informant made, and this is all out of FBI files. Anybody right. can get at the National Archives. But then the FBI kept all this stuff covered up, you know, for the last 20 right. years, and you're hearing about it for the first time right now.
Again, the book is Legacy of Secrecy, Lamar Waldron. Can you, in 90 seconds, explain why Lee Harvey Oswald didn't do it alone or didn't do it at all, either way?
Well, JFK's two closest aides in the limo right behind JFK's limo saw the shots from the grassy knoll, as did a Secret Service agent in that car. One of those men talked not only to my co-author Tom Hartman, this is Dave Powers when he was head of the JFK library years later, but these two JFK aides told their story to Tip O'Neill, Speaker of the House of Representatives in the 1980s. Tip O'Neill put it in his autobiography that's in most libraries in America, where these two men, these two loyal JFK aides say, yeah, we saw the shots from the knoll, but they had to change their story for the good of the country. And in many ways, that's what Legacy of Secrecy is about, is why that had to be done. But the other big thing in Legacy of Secrecy is how all that secrecy allowed some of those same people to later assassinate Martin Luther King and also Bobby Kennedy himself.
Well, let's get to that then. Next, we could do four shows about the information that's in Legacy of Secrecy, but let's address that then, the connection, the mafia / low-level CIA / racist Ku Klux Klan connection to the assassination of Martin Luther King and to Bobby Kennedy. They are all connected through the mafia, through the information uncovered by Lamar Waldron with Tom Hartman. We'll get to all of those assassinations, too, and we'll start getting your phone calls coming up on Coast to Coast AM. It's our annual JFK assassination show. This is Ian Punnett. You know, there are so many details to get to yet in the book Legacy of Secrecy that we probably won't have a time for many calls, but we will get some coming up this hour for Lamar Waldron, co-author of the book with Tom Hartman. And when we last left the narrative of this of these series of confessions that had come out from Carlos Marcello and Johnny Rosselli and other major crime figures related to the JFK assassination, we got up to the part about Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, being associated with the assassination of this by the same group. And we'll get to that next. How are these all connected? Next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So, Lamar Waldron, before we get to some callers and what might be, at least on the surface, a very weird connection with a past guest on this subject, which I'll get to a little bit later on, let's get to the part about JFK's assassination being linked to RFK and to Martin Luther King through the mafia. Because I thought that part of Legacy of Secrecy really helped fill in some blanks I've always had about the assassination of Martin Luther King in particular.
Yeah, who was James Earl Ray? How did he, this penny any criminal, get involved? It all stems from the cover-ups right after JFK's murder of both Carlos Marcello and a white supremacist from Georgia named Joseph Miltier, who had a very small role in the JFK assassination plot. In fact, Joseph Miltier was recorded on Miami police informant tape about 2 weeks before Dallas, saying that JFK would be shot from a building with a high-powered rifle. And so you can imagine they had that tape. That was quite startling to them.
Right.
The FBI began investigating that, but the investigation was botched because Hoover would not let the FBI agent investigating know about those police tapes or about the Tampa attempt. So JFK was killed, but Hoover had to cover up this intelligence failure about Miltier. They had been investigating this guy, and then what he predicted actually happened. The same thing happened with Carlos Marcello after the assassination. A dozen associates of Carlos Marcello, Marcello's family, and Marcello's top lieutenants were interviewed or arrested by the FBI, and yet you won't find Carlos Marcello's name anywhere in the Warren report. So those two investigations were botched, and you know, when you have one botched investigation, you have to keep covering that up. Well, let's flash ahead then to 1968. Joseph Miltier, who had a very small role in JFK's murder, white supremacist, associate of J.B. Stoner, affiliate of the Klan, also a member of a group called the Citizens Councils. There were lots of them across the South, and they were called the Klan in Suits and Ties, the White Citizens Council. So Joseph Miltier had a small inheritance, which he supplemented by bilking Atlanta's highest paid factory workers of some of their paychecks every week. Ian, I remember listening to you in Atlanta years ago.
Yeah, how about that?
On WGST. Atlanta radio.
Sure.
And I don't know if you remember the Lakewood General Motors plant near the federal penitentiary by any chance.
Oh, I most certainly do, yes. And okay. he was out there scarfing money off those guys?
Yeah, there were over 7,000 people worked there. And that area, the Lakewood area, was unfortunately one of the areas of Atlanta worst hit by blockbusting in the mid-1960s. So the area had kind of been a hotbed of the head of the Klan had once worked there. But then things had gotten better, and that whole area went for John F. Kennedy in 1960.
You better, Lamar, just for purposes of people outside of the South, explain blockbusting for people that don't. They may associate that with the movies, and that's not what you're talking about.
Blockbusting for you younger folks under the age of 50 or 40 was in the 1960s when, especially in the South, the cities were segregated. And you would literally have like a street, and on north of this street, homes were only sold to white folks. South of that street, they were sold to black folks. Well, that kind of discrimination started to be torn down, but large real estate firms would kind of take advantage of this situation and they would target, they would literally carve up a city and say, well, we will sell homes to black folks in this area, and we're going to try to sell a lot of them real fast, and then we won't sell homes to black folks up in this area where the real estate firm owners live. And it really, you know, it kind of turned, it turned a lot of in the area around the Lakewood General Motors plant. You had men that, you know, lived 5 or 10 minutes from work where they lived for 10 or 20 years, and suddenly their whole neighborhood is undergoing this upheaval, and these real estate firms are using really sleazy tactics to scare them and get them out. And so you had a lot of anger about that. You had politicians in Georgia, like Lester
sure.
Maddox. And this Lakewood area, there was even like an all-star racist rally with Lester Maddox and George Wallace and all these guys and the Klan leaders. And now I later worked at this plant and when I was in college. And of the 7,000 people, vast majority of those men and some women, hardworking, great, decent folks. But a certain percentage, every Friday, these were highly paid union workers, would give a little bit of money to Joseph Miltier, his associate who worked at the plant, a man who died just a year or two ago named Hugh Spake, and a couple of their associates. And this little four-man clique would collect money to fight civil rights. Okay, and they would give out various forms of literature and that kind of stuff. And this was safer for the men to do than, say, joining the Klan, because the
right.
FBI was cracking on the Klan membership list. This way you could feel like you were, you know, they were channeling that that anger that the racist politicians were ginning up, and this was a way to do that. Now, Miltier and his associates were actually using that money to buy up undeveloped mountain land in North Carolina. So you had racists bilking other racists, essentially.
Right.
And this started around 1965. Well, by 1968, some of those men had been giving money for quite a while. Now, if you were a very regular contributor, and let's say you were giving money, you know, for 6 months, and you were just, you know, rabidly racist, eventually they would tell you, you know, this money isn't just going to fight civil rights in general. This money is going to kill Martin Luther King. And that would be your incentive, like a secret club sort of thing, and you'd probably increase your contribution. Well, by 1968, though, you know, if you've been giving that money and you're one of these hardcore racists, and some of those people were in the Klan, we know what the Klan is capable of, you know, so Miltier and his buddies were like, you know, they'd made a bunch of money, and they'd spent a lot of it on this land. They had a lot, but now they were under pressure to show some reaction, some results.
Right.
They tried recruiting, you know, their own hitman. They didn't want to use anybody related to any of their racist groups, you know, to J.B. Stoner or anybody like that. Miltier was very close to J.B. Stoner. So, you know, you had to get outside of these groups. You know, in 1968, it wasn't, you know, and this was Atlanta. This wasn't, you know, Mississippi. So we document all these attempts of trying to find a hitman. Well, according to one Justice Department file that was withheld from congressional investigators in the late 70s, of the mafia, specifically people tied in with Marcello, Marcello essentially brokered the hit contract on King. Now, Marcello was a huge racist. He had used racist Miltier and another one named Guy Bannister in the JFK attempt. All of the strikes, demonstrations, and boycotts that King was leading were greatly disrupting Marcello's vice operations throughout the Southeast. Most people don't realize Martin Luther King had declared war on the mafia just a couple of years earlier because they preyed on the minority communities in Atlanta with their gambling and vice. So Marcello was glad to help, and he made $200,000, a million in today's dollars. Basically, he didn't accept the contract. He just brokered it. He set up, apparently, Miltier with one or two of his subordinates, and we name them in the book. And James Earl Ray was a low-level heroin runner for Carlos Marcello's organization. That's how Ray came to get into the picture to start with. Now, most people know that Martin Luther King was killed in Memphis, Tennessee, and James Earl Ray fled to Canada. Okay. Now, if you look at a map of Memphis and Canada, Atlanta is nowhere between Memphis and Canada.
Right. Yeah.
And
you go a little out of your way to get to Atlanta from
Well,
Memphis.
Exactly 450 miles out of your way, heading south to Atlanta first on the way to Canada. Now, no one has ever had a good explanation for why Ray came 450 miles south, stayed in Atlanta a few hours, then left. Well, the reason was he came back to Atlanta, James Earl Ray did. He called Hugh Spake. Hugh Spake then contacted Miltier some way. Miltier later admitted to a friend in a letter he was in that area where, get this, James Earl Ray abandoned his getaway car just in a housing project just a few blocks from Martin Luther King's church and office. Most people overlook that. And yet he abandoned the car 3 miles from this little rooming house he'd been staying in. The thing is, though, the place where he abandoned his car, near the Georgia State Capitol, by the way, is halfway between that Atlanta auto plant and Ray's rooming house. So Joseph Miltier helped Ray get, then escape from Atlanta, go to Canada, go to England, go to Portugal, back to England where he was captured. Huge embarrassment to J. Edgar Hoover. Some people think that J. Edgar Hoover killed Martin Luther King because he did all these terrible propaganda things and tried to make it suicide. But I can tell you, if J. Edgar Hoover had killed Martin Luther King, he would have made sure the perpetrator was caught, you know, within hours, if not a day, because that was hugely embarrassing for the FBI, for a penny-ante criminal like Ray to be on the run for 2 months. But most people are unaware of Ray's involvement with Marcello's drug network.
Right.
And eventually, of course, J.B. Stoner, who is Miltier's associate, became James Earl Ray's attorney.
Well, hang on, and we could go to the RFK shooting, but let's put that off to a different show, because they make a natural connection here, but again, they come through Carlos Marcello, who then confesses to his involvement, and this is what we're talking about, all of the details you have in the book, and I wanted to leave a little time for some callers, and I wanted to also take 2 minutes for you to tell me who did the actual shooting in Dallas, as you research it in Legacy of Secrecy, who are those that are there that day that pull the trigger? And then who's there that doesn't shoot, but's there to make sure that it gets done?
Okay. From the best research we've done, the FBI and the CIA said that a man by the name of Michael Victor Mertz was deported from Dallas the day after the assassination. Michael Victor Mertz was a heroin smuggling. He really helped to refine the classic French Connection technique of smuggling heroin in on cars, just like in the movie. And his network interfaced with that of Marcello and Trafficante. He was a notorious French criminal and assassin. Just an amazing sort of guy, the kind of guy who would collaborate with the Nazis in World War II. Then when the Nazis started losing, he picked up a machine gun and shot a restaurant full of Nazis and joined the resistance and won the French Legion of Honor. And so he had a lot of protection with French intelligence. So Michael Victor Mertz, like I say, according to the FBI and CIA, he was in Dallas. He worked for Marcello and Trafficante. He's a very high-level guy. Very ruthless, almost never photographed, and so he was there. Charles Nicoletti, a Chicago hitman who had a car specially modified to hold assassination weapons, and none of the cars behind the grassy knoll were searched, by the way. There are reports Charles Nicoletti was in Dallas. That would be possible. There are reports Johnny Roselli was in Dallas. You know, I can't credit those completely. They don't rise to the level we usually require. I can tell you that an associate of E. Howard Hunt was in Dallas and was identified on the grassy knoll. So
was that David Morales?
Well, we won't go into details there. And there are reports.
Won't we go into details there? I'm missing something. I'm sorry.
That's actually in the book. But you brought up David Morales. Now there are people that say that David Morales was in Texas, in Dealey Plaza, maybe even in the school book depository. You know, there's not solid evidence of that, but Cuban intelligence claims that. I take what they say with a big grain of salt, but you know that can't be ruled out. I would say there is the group that you're kind of working with, and it's a pretty lethal, you know, high level, deadly group of people that could pull this off.
Now, how about the reports, and then we'll get to Richard in Vegas first here in just a minute, so we'll have to keep it short. But what does it rise to the level of proof for you that that Jack Ruby was there in Dallas at the school book depository the day of the shooting?
Well, he was seen in the vicinity of the depository, and it's interesting. He was carrying $7,000 in cash and a pistol, and he disappeared from the Dallas Morning News, I think it was, just before JFK's motorcade came through. So you might wonder, why is this guy having $7,000 in cash on him and a pistol? That's just kind of odd. Jack Ruby was seen in Houston, Texas, the day before at the site of JFK's motorcade there by, I believe, 7 witnesses. So, yeah, Jack Ruby was definitely part of the plot to kill JFK and may well have been in or around Dealey Plaza at the time of the shooting.
Let's get to Richard in Vegas on Coast to Coast AM. We won't get many callers on for Lamar Waldron, but Richard, you luck out. You're first.
All right. Thank you, Ian. Great show. I'll be quick here. A couple quick things. I've always been concerned about Colby and the CIA and how he magically and mystically disappeared when he took that fateful boat trip. And
the canoe trip,
anything,
right, yeah.
And the second thing is, I don't think that Genovese or Lucchese can be left out of this equation because they did a lot of running around.
Lamar?
Well, you know, there are a lot of interesting mafia guys, but what we tried to focus on were the ones that, you know, that Bobby Kennedy focused on. And Bobby Kennedy told people before he died that, you know, Carlos Marcello, that the godfather of New Orleans, was behind his brother's death. So we're not trying to look at who could be involved. I mean, we've cast a wide net, but then you wind up focusing, where does the evidence lead, you know, and what did the people who really had the inside knowledge, the people that work with Bobby, where did they point us? And when we followed those leads, that's where we literally struck gold, found all these documents in the National Archives that backed up what they said. So, and as for Colby, yeah, his disappearance was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I the more time passes and the more I realize all the things that Colby knew, and the things that Colby was willing to talk about. I mean, the thing, he'd kind of been sort of vocal, and I think his death seems more and more mysterious to me. First-time caller line, Mark is in Sacramento for Lamar Waldron, author of Legacy of Secrecy. Mark?
Yeah, let me just say, I'm concerned that this is kind of a one-sided examination, because there's a book that came out a few years ago, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, by Vincent Bugliosi, called Reclaiming History, which pretty much debunks most of the conspiracy theories on the Kennedy assassination and pretty well, and mentions a lot of these people that this your guest is mentioning, such as Joseph Miltier and E. Howard Hunt and so forth, you know, basically stating that all these theories basically just raise questions, never come up with any concrete answers.
You know,
Mark,
I just got to stop you because we're running out of time here. But I can tell you, I've interviewed Bugliosi, and I've read this book, and I would be curious to see how Bugliosi would respond to the detail and the attributions that are in this book, because I don't think he really can. And I'm not saying that Bugliosi doesn't have an interesting point of view or that it's not a good book. What I'm saying is, I think it's unfair to go back and say, well, Bugliosi answered it once and for all, because he couldn't have, because his book hadn't come out yet. And I think that the details in here that Lamar Waldron has come up with and the way that it fits together, Bugliosi can't explain. But I would rather leave Bugliosi the chance to say that. And so we'll just leave it up to Lamar Waldron then to respond to the thought about how has all this information been debunked and how could he come up with a book on that? And we'll let Lamar respond to that next. And then it may be kind of a weird connection, but I have to bring in a past guest here to ask you a question about the JFK Association next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So, Lamar Waldron, why can you say that this is new information, or that Vincent Bugliosi or other debunkers, so-called debunkers in the past, haven't already handled all of this and there's nothing new to be learned in the JFK assassination?
Well, aside from the fact they would have had to have had a time machine to come into the future to do stuff that hadn't been written yet, I welcome the chance to talk about this because Vincent Bugliosi was going to be on my co-author Tom Hartman's radio show after his own book came out. And the funny thing was, as soon as Variety announced that I was going to be on the show as well, Vincent Bugliosi canceled. So I've never actually had the chance to speak to Mr. Bugliosi, but what people reading his book often don't realize, because his book basically rubber stamps, essentially, the Warren Report.
Right.
But what most people reading his book don't realize is that the Warren Commission was only the first of six government committees and commissions that investigated the JFK assassination, and the later ones, such as the House Select Committee on Assassinations, had access to far more information, and they reached a conspiracy conclusion, pointing the finger at Carlos Marcello and Santo Trafficante. So I can give you just a couple of brief examples. Vincent Bugliosi doesn't mention anything about Commander Almeida, even though we released that information before his deadline, because, you know, he can't, that doesn't fit his theory. He mentions the Tampa attempt that Tom and I discovered, and he basically says, well, even if someone did try to assassinate JFK in a motorcade in Tampa 4 days before Dallas from, you know, from a high building with a high-powered rifle, that means nothing. That has nothing to do with Dallas. So I'm like, huh, what? But here's something I'll give your listeners tonight. This is something your listeners can use with anyone who brings up Bugliosi in the future, or the Warren Report, or anything who says there wasn't a conspiracy. Bugliosi and the Warren Report say that Lee Harvey Oswald was a teenage communist and a Marxist and went to Russia, came back, and blah, blah, blah. Well, ask yourself, how many teenage communists do you know that joined the Civil Air Patrol? How many teenage communists do you know, especially in the McCarthy 50s, but even today, that not only joined the United States Marines, but joined the United States, try to join the U.S. Marines a year before they're old enough? Okay, that's weird enough. Then when they're in the Marines, they go around spouting their love of communism and Russia so much and studying Russian that their Marine buddies call him Osvaldovich as a nickname. But guess how many times Oswald's Marine drill sergeants ever wrote him up for punishment for this self-professed love of Russia? Exactly zero. None. Because he was doing this as part of his intelligence operation. When Oswald was a child, his favorite TV show was I Led Three Lives, about a man who goes under deep cover. His father died before Oswald was born, but Oswald's two older brothers were in the military. One was in an intelligence service. Oswald was one of five men to go to Russia around the same time, defect, come back with Russian wives. During the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Lee Harvey Oswald, just back from Russia with his Russian wife, is allowed to get a job here in Dallas at a firm that makes maps from U-2 spy plane photos.
I mean, it's just that's inconceivable.
Yeah.
It's inconceivable. And I think the part, and it almost sounded like a throwaway, but to me it was really key that Lee Harvey Oswald's favorite show as a kid was about a guy who pretends he's a communist, goes deep undercover to serve his country. I thought that was so telling because that really does, seems like explains a lot.
Well, and in the Warren Commission volumes, there are notes where, now not the report, but in the supporting volumes, which Bugliosi claims to have read, I'll take him on his word, there are notes for apparently a speech that Oswald planned to give after his big reveal, as we would call it today, where he's talking about how much he hates communism and all this kind of stuff, and he's going to be better than the guy that I Led Three Lives was based on and stuff. And so, yeah, so like I said, okay, you can use that on people. You know, so most of Bugliosi's arguments for the single bullet, magic bullet, lone nut assassination scenario theory, those have been debunked years ago. He's re-resurrecting arguments that have already been debunked. Listen, if there were 5 or 10 or 20 clear, unimpeached reasons that Lee Harvey Oswald and him alone could have killed JFK, Bugliosi could have written a much slimmer book. But, you know, I can find no unimpeached evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin, because it's all been contested at different times quite well, in my opinion.
I need 60 seconds from you on why it's significant that in this new autographed edition of the Warren Commission, President Gerald R. Ford finally admits that the CIA destroyed documents after the assassination. Why is that significant?
Well, as people who read Legacy of Secrecy will see, I mean, a big part of the story is Richard Helms, that guy who was literally caught with his hand in the cookie jar when JFK was killed while he was working with the mafia. And he later became CIA director under LBJ and Nixon. So, you know, you had cover-ups legitimately by Bobby and the CIA director in 63 and people to protect Commander Almeida to prevent World War III. But then you had these cover-ups to protect intelligence failures and screw-ups, basically. So I'm not surprised those documents were destroyed. What your listeners need to know is there are a million CIA files alone that are still secret today and have not been released, being kept secret till 2017, despite the law requiring their release. You know, and if your listeners contact their congressperson or senator and say, hey, you guys passed the JFK Act in 1992.
Right.
And there are a million files still secret. And the last chapter of Legacy of Secrecy is basically, you know, starting to compile a list of these documents, because so many files that we do write about indicate the presence of other files that have not been released yet.
Well, and that's a perfect intro to this, too. I was talking the other night with Galen Cook, who's an investigator. He's an attorney out of Seattle, and he and I have been spending a lot of time on the air trying to track the true identity of D.B. Cooper, right, the successful parachutist and the guy who was able to skyjack a plane for thousands of dollars. And he emailed me and said that this guy, Bill Gossett, that we've been talking about, used to claim to his wife that he had, when he was in the military and he was working for military justice, that he had come across some files which implicated the military's involvement in the assassination of JFK. And that is a thread that comes up periodically, the military's involvement. Can you speak to that,
Sure. I'm glad you brought that up, because Oliver Stone's JFK movie had a lot of great stuff in it, but the stuff about Mr. X, you know, wasn't. And he would show the shadowy generals, especially, like, I believe, at JFK's autopsy. And so a lot of people, younger people especially today, think, well, okay, the military, you know, JFK, you know, he wouldn't do Vietnam, blah, blah. But that's actually a misreading of history for two big reasons. One is JFK had appointed, he'd gotten rid of some of the military that were against him. His Joint Chiefs of Staff had JFK's trust. Bobby trusted the Joint Chiefs Chairman Maxwell Taylor so much, he named his son Max Kennedy after him. You know, the Navy head at the time of the Bay of Pigs was not a great guy. He had been replaced twice by that time. So
there's a military connection to this, or that the military might have had files on the JFK assassination?
Well, now you got to remember, the military had the lead role in the coup plan, the CIA a supporting role. So the U.S. military had even more reason to see this coup plan go forward, because they had the lead role in the operation. So, but again, only a handful of high military leaders knew. So what I have to say is no evidence has ever surfaced, and the people who were in a position who could have done it if they had wanted to, Joint Chief Chairman Maxwell Taylor and head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, General Carroll, father of James Carroll, the novelist, you know, they were both Kennedy loyalists, and
right.
Kennedy trusted them. So, yeah, Air Force General Curtis LeMay, I wouldn't trust him as far as I could throw him, but he, you know, he wasn't involved with Oswald. He wasn't in a position to do any of this sort of thing. So there's simply no evidence on the military side. That doesn't say the military didn't have a lot to cover up, and we write in the book about the secret military, the Naval Intelligence Investigation of the assassination that determined that Lee Harvey Oswald was incapable of masterminding the assassination and also incapable of doing the actual shooting. That's military intelligence conclusion,
okay.
Not mine.
Let me bring in Galen Cook, the attorney I spoke of. This is Lamar Waldron. Lamar, Galen, Lamar. Galen, does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And thanks again, Ian, for having me on. And Lamar, great show. I've been following the whole thing. Lamar, just to let you know, my primary focus on my investigation has always strictly been to learn the true identity of D.B. Cooper. And I've interviewed dozens of people, and I've always thought that the motive for the D.B. Cooper case was strictly about money. But after talking with the widow a few times, a lady who lives in Portland, with Bill Gossett's wife, and talking with an attorney out in Oregon who was a good friend of Gossett, they've both informed me that Gossett had told them several times that during his stint in the military back in the 60s, he had come across some files about the JFK assassination, and Gossett has also revealed that he was D.B. Cooper, and I don't have any exacting proof to show this, but I've always been a little interested, since I've talked with these two witnesses, why the D.B. Cooper jump date was November 24th and why the JFK assassination date was November 22nd.
Well,
They're closely linked in that time period.
And I guess actually the D.B. Cooper jump date would be what they call Jack Ruby Day here in Oswald. Here in Dallas.
Right. Well, Galen, I appreciate that, and that's another conversation sometime, and thank you for throwing that up. I just thought it was an interesting connection with our past conversations. We'll get to a couple other callers here. Let's go to Andrew, who's in L.A. for Lamar Waldron, the co-author of Legacy of Secrecy. Andrew? Did I hit it right, or did I not hit it right? Okay, I'll try it again. Andrew, are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead.
And I think your guest is onto something. First of all, you missed a great opportunity in when St. John Hunt mentioned the murder of his mother. Some investigators believe that the Chicago flight that landed.
Right. We've talked about that at length.
Right.
We talked about that at length in the past, and I just didn't want to get off of the JFK discussion. But, yes, we actually St. John Hunt and I have talked about that in great detail about his mother's murder, that he believes his mother was murdered. Yeah.
Right. She was on a United flight with Michelle Clark, a CBS reporter, and suddenly the plane lost all power in the electronics at the Midway Airport. I went to that crash site, by the way, hours afterwards, and it destroyed the whole city block.
Oh, I know.
On both sides. But anyway,
make
a long story short, do you believe there's any truth to the story that John Kennedy Jr., was about to have an expose in his George magazine about the true assassins who were behind his father's death?
Interesting, Andrew. I hadn't heard that. Any truth to that rumor, Lamar?
I've heard the rumor is all I can say, and I think I talked to one guy once who had been in touch with Robert Kennedy Jr., who had shown an interest in it. So I've never seen any evidence that there was an expose getting ready to run. He hadn't expressed an interest, which is more than a lot of members of the Kennedy family do, which is quite understandable because this is a very painful, private, personal matter for them.
Right.
So I don't know about that. But you mentioned about E. Howard Hunt's wife being killed, and whether she was murdered or not, I do want to let people know in Legacy of Secrecy, there's a chapter or two about Watergate, and people would be shocked at how much the events of 1963 and all the cover-ups then kind of boomerang back and come back up in Watergate, which people have wondered for years, well, why was it Cuban exiles? You know,
right.
Why E. Howard, you know, why would Cuban exiles, you know, why? Well, the reason was, if we actually show the document, a page of it for the first time in Legacy of Secrecy, that they were actually looking for. They were looking for a report that Castro had prepared, and they thought the Democrats might have it. They'd broken into the Chilean embassy. Most people overlook that. And it listed all of the CIA assassination plots that Fidel Castro knew about starting in 1960 when E. Howard Hunt was working with Richard Nixon on Cuba and when the Mafia was first hired. The worry was if that came out before the 72 election, that could cost Richard Nixon the election. And but because Commander Almeida was still in power, his family was still outside of Cuba getting money set up by E. Howard Hunt and Bobby Kennedy – Richard Helms could use someone like E. Howard Hunt to look for that document, you know, on the national security grounds. It might reveal Commander Almeida. Richard Nixon wanted it because it could embarrass him, and that's why those particular people were involved on that particular episode.
Let's get to Susan in Ohio on Coast to Coast AM for Lamar Waldron, co-author of Legacy of Secrecy. Susan?
Hi. Yes, my mother had sent me a picture out of her paper sometime after John Kennedy's assassination, and it was a group picture along the side of the road, and they had circled the faces of E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis in that group, and I was wondering if you would find that significant.
Well, I can tell you, Tom and I studied that a great deal in the early 90s, looking very, very hard. And like I said, this guy named Chauncey Holt claimed to be one of these three tramps. And there have actually been two different people identified as Hunt. And some of the really top photo experts have looked, and, you know, they're just not there. So we and a lot of other people looked hard at that, and
just not there. But again, a good question, because that does still float around out there.
Francis is in L.A. on Coast to Coast AM for Lamar Waldron. Francis?
I Led Three Lives was one of my favorites, too. And Herb Philbert was a real guy.
Oh, yeah.
I met him. I wanted to know, do you know of Murchison out of Texas?
Right, Clint Murchison.
Right. There was a development off of St. Petersburg, Florida, called Guylain Barlow's Protocol on the Bayway Isles, and it was started by the Berlanti brothers, and it was bankrolled by Murchison and a few others. And
we just have a minute here, okay. So if there's a question,
anyway,
go ahead.
The Berlanti brothers, they had a private airstrip there. They had taken off towards Miami or the Glades, and their plane was blown up over Lake Okeechobee on the way back. And this was when they were planning for the Bay of Pigs invasion. And after they got killed, Murchison pulled out, and everything just went to rack and ruin on Tierra Verde.
Well, a thought on that, Lamar?
Not really. But, okay. It's probably good. She mentions Clint Murchison. Let me just point out, some people, you know, think that Texas oil men or, and not this caller, but I'm just using this, where LBJ killed JFK. But turns out some of those big Texas oil men were in hot deep to the mafia and to Jimmy Hoffa. And, of course, Lyndon Johnson. Once you realize that there were attempts in Chicago and in Tampa before Dallas, and Bobby Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy, they never suspected Lyndon Johnson at all, because if I was going to kill somebody, I wouldn't have bullets whizzing over my head,
right?
To get to my target.
Well, let's just say that's not the end of the show, but someday we'll get back to the RFK part,
okay.
Legacy of Secrecy. Lamar Waldron, I look forward to having you back on and to finish reading this book. And thank you for helping us try to get it all in there in the four hours that we had.
You've done a great job. And by the way, if people want to know more, they can go to legacyofsecrecy.com. And I look forward to talking about Robert Kennedy's assassination at some point.
Thank you so much, Lamar Waldron. Thank you, everybody. Didn't get it all in. Sorry, William, to leave you stranded up there. We'll try it again coming up soon. And, of course, next year, again, on our annual JFK show. Hope you have a great week. Deus te amat. And I do, too.